might be intended.
They open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today is November 18th, 2009. It's just after 8 a.m. I wanted to welcome and thank committee members for obliging an 8 o'clock start time. We have a joint committee after a break, and our ABLE committee staff reminds me that if you'll just leave your things in their places, they will be assigned correctly as the dais is reset. You don't have to do anything.
Just ignore me.
The agenda is fairly straightforward. We've got in the initial part of our solo meeting discussions about a couple issues that some I think are just fun for us to get to hear about, that not all agriculture occurs in rural areas, and a couple projects that I ran into over the summer that I thought I would share with you all. And then the next portion, the farmers markets, is a discussion about farmers markets are growing, and there are some issues that are coming up that the department and our vendors, I think, need probably some guidance from the legislative body about. And so we're going to hear some about how the department views farmers markets, how the vendors are viewing the department's view of farmers markets, and then see if there's any actions we need to take going forward. And then we go into some wildlife stuff and a little bit of land use stuff with the joint committee. So that's the plan for the day, and I will get us started. I think we'll have Rosalie and the folks from Village Gardens come up first. They're a group that is in, I'll let them tell you more about them, but I met them this summer at a conference about food systems and food security and what they're up to in North Portland, and thought everybody would enjoy getting to hear what they're doing up there. So please, come on forward.
They're eating food from North Portland. That's what they're doing.
Sometimes they're goats.
They're grown there.
People jobs. It's really pretty
amazing. Oh, wow.
So that's
okay. And one thing about the Capitol, because we're recording everything so people can listen to it on the internet, just state your names before you start talking, just so they know who's talking. It's hard to keep track when you can't see. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Rosalie Karp, and I'm with Janus Youth Programs. And we're really pleased to have this opportunity to be here to share with you what Village Gardens is all about. What I'm going to do is just kind of set a little bit of the stage, because Janus Youth Programs is one of those agencies in the state of Oregon, as well as seven programs that we operate in the state of Washington, that our Village Gardens program is a little bit different from what historically we have done from the standpoint of our residential programs that are contracted with the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Youth Authority, our runaway and homeless youth services, our alternative education programs, the teen parent services that we provide through Insights Teen Parent Program. Village Gardens started back in 2001, and at that time we were approached by a group of residents from the St. John's Woods Public Housing Development, which is a housing development of the Housing Authority of Portland. And at that time, the thought of Janus Youth Programs applying for a USDA grant was almost something that we were kind of scratching our heads about and couldn't quite figure out. This seemed like a really odd thing for us to do. But we applied for a USDA grant, not really thinking that we would probably be selected, but lo and behold, we were. So in 2001, Village Gardens started first in St. John's Woods, proved to be so successful that the Housing Authority of Portland, as they were in the planning stages for the redevelopment of the former Columbia Villa Tamaracks to be redeveloped under Hope 6 programs to become the new Columbia, had seen such dramatic changes in the communities that they approached us about putting in a garden in New Columbia. Well, again, when you're funded by USDA, you're often not selected again, but we thought, well, we would try, because we certainly didn't have the money to put in another garden program. We were selected, received another USDA grant that also allowed us then to expand not only into the Columbia, into New Columbia, but to also start a one-acre farm on Sovey Island in a partnership with Metro. So since that time, and with much support from the USDA and from many private families, foundations. We now have 85,000 square feet of land in production in Portland that is really modeled on a community community health model to really address hunger, poverty, employment, social determinants of health that really embrace these communities. And I think with all of the pieces that have been in the news of late in regards to the growing hunger issue and food insecurity issues, not only on a national level but also in Oregon, I think it's really really kind of timely that all of these programs are here today to let you know what's going on in the food system in Oregon and in Portland. So I'm going to turn over to Amber Baker, who is our program director for Village Gardens, and she's going to let you know what the program is about, and then our community residents as well.
Hi, I'm Amber Baker, the program director at Village Gardens. I wanted to also thank you all for inviting us to come today and share about the work that we do. I want to also just mention that there are other folks from Village Gardens here who are not going to be speaking today. Lavette Lacey, who's a youth crew member, Patricia Brown, who's a community volunteer and leader in St. John's Woods, Michelle Hanna, who's on the Seeds of Harmony Garden Committee in New Columbia and Tamarack, Mr. Wasangalo, who's a garden advocate on staff with us, Carissa Savage, who's our AmeriCorps volunteer working with community programs, and Jason Skipton, who is also on staff supporting community programs. So Rosalie shared with you a little bit about what Village Gardens is doing. Our model really works in partnership with community residents from public housing neighborhoods in North Portland to run multi-generational and multifaceted programming. We have two major branches of our program. There's our community programs, which support two resident-led community gardens located within the public housing neighborhoods. We have a children's program at each of those sites as well that's run by adults from the community. We also have a new livestock project committee that's working together in between youth and adults to create a chicken egg cooperative project that's going to be launching this season. And then the other side of our program is our FoodWorks youth program, really focusing on developing youth opportunities in the neighborhood for youth ages 14 to 21. The youth and FoodWorks really focus on growing their farm. They work on growing their community. They work on growing their business, and they work on growing themselves. And Markeisha is going to share a little bit more about that with you all. Again, our model really focuses on empowering community leaders to run the program. So our full-time staff work to support, build capacity, train, and back up residents, both youth and adults from the neighborhood, in implementing and supporting the rest of the community through our projects. Some of the fruits of our labor, we really see that it is helping to build community health from the ground. We're helping to build relationships between folks from outside the community like myself and residents from within the community, as well as bringing folks together from different backgrounds within the neighborhoods where we're working. We're working to build skills, employment opportunities, and actual jobs for community members. We had 22 youth involved in our training program this year, 7 adults on staff, and another 20 adults who are involved in leadership roles throughout the organization. We work on creating income through the youth farm business, as well as spreading out food bills within the families who are able to provide food and cut down on their food costs and their household budgets. And I think the most important thing that we're growing from this project is really a sense of hope within the neighborhood. We spend a lot of time visioning together what would happen, what could happen if the community really looked like what we would want it to look like, and then put our energy and resources and time into helping to get there, using food throughout our program as our sort of organizing tool, the piece that's really bringing us together. So with that, I'll pass it to Angela, who's going to share a little bit about her experience, and then some of the other folks as well.
Hi, thanks for having us. Like you said, my name is Angela Martin, and where shall I begin? I've been with Village Gardens since it started. And how did I get started is through my kids and Tara. And I started through my kids. Like I said, I was looking in my window, and my daughter, she was out there screaming and hollering talking about, Mom, you need to come down. You need to come down. This lady is not out here doing this right. So I'm ignoring her, telling her, I'm not coming down here. Let her do this stuff. And she kept screaming. So I was like, okay, well, I'm coming down. So I came down, and I was like, you're not doing that. You let these kids run you over. So I start basically taking over. And I met the Tara. And my kids ain't never in life ate no salads. They was coming home eating salads. So I had to confront Tara about it. And I was like, you got my kids eating salads. And then from there, we just start talking and stuff. And I start working there doing the for AmeriCorps for 2 years. And then after the 2 years, I went to pay staff. And I love it. I mean, I'm doing it for the kids because the kids is the ones that, the future. The kids is our future. And it helps on food. It saves a whole lot of money. And it's just, I mean, I wouldn't do nothing else. I wouldn't do nothing else. It's worth it. Pass it down to her.
Hey, hi, my name is Markeisha Duckett. I am a crew member of Food Works Club. And I just want to tell you the four things we grow on our farm in Food Works. It's business, community, self, and team. I mean, farm. And I want to start off with business because our business is what we need to grow our farm. And what we do with this business is we sell food to farmers market, New Seasons. And this year we sold over $10,000 of food and gave out about 5,700 pounds of free food to the community. And sometimes our business is most active in the summertime because that's the time when vegetables and fruits and stuff like to grow most often. In our community, we always like to do free food pass out to people who need food and like to... And our crew members that at Food Works like to pick and harvest all the food for everyone. So, yeah. And I want to talk about myself and what it did for me, which it taught me how to be a great gardener because I didn't know how to do nothing at first. And it taught me more job experience with communication with people, teamwork, leadership, and how to be sitting right here with you guys today to talk to you. And then I want to talk about the farm, which is 1 acre on Sabi Island, straight organic farm, and we like to just grow all vegetables, corn, potatoes, tomatoes, from beets to pumpkins, from cucumbers to flowers. You know, it's pretty fun out there, and we like to just have a great time out on the farm. So I'm going to pass it to Eric Bottle and let him say something.
Hello, I just want to say thank you very much for having us here today. It is an honor. I really feel happy. My name is Igbovada Nanuko. I'm from Togo, West Africa. I moved to the U.S. In 2000, November 2000. And 6 years ago, my dad took, I know this is a little bit off the subject, but 6 years ago, my dad took the citizenship test, and now I'm a U.S. citizen, which is great. I've been with Village Garden for about 5 years now. I started it as a youth, Food Works youth, and I started out with the Food Works youth. At first, after my first year with, you know, this wonderful youth, I learned the importance of my communities and the needs in my community. So I wanted to take on a bigger challenge. So I talked with the former program director of Village Garden, which is Tara Cashman, and I told her that, look, I want to, you know, be more involved in the community. How do I get more involved in the community? And we had a children's gardening program in this huge community, New Columbia, and you know, and at that time it wasn't being run really well. So I said, look, I would love to take on this challenge. I think I'm definitely ready for it, and you know, and so we talked about it and everything, and I got this job and working with the children and stuff. When I got this job, the first thing that came to my mind was, like, right away was, you know, children's and the youths are first. You know, I mean, yeah, they are first. So, I mean, why a young man will think that, you know, the children's and the youth are first? Yeah. So I realized that, look, you know, whatever we do now will affect the future, our next generation. So I said, you know, I want to do something good for the next generation. And so I said, I want to lead these groups of kids, young youth, and plus I have the strength too, and I have the leadership skill too, especially being with the youth food works and stuff. So what I want to talk about here is I want to mainly speak on the behalf of all the immigrants that live in these communities, that we work with, that Village Garden work with in these communities. So Village Garden have been around for, you know, in these two communities for about four to eight years now. Without this organization, I don't really think, you know, immigrants will feel as comfortable as they feel right now in this communities. It's really, you know, what this organization is doing is really important. And because of Village Gardens, African immigrants, Mexican immigrants, and many other immigrants feel like they belong in a safe environment, safe communities where they feel like their words matter and the skills that they brought from their cultures, matters. This is what people, you know, one thing that I personally kind of realize is that people don't get so much is, you know, welcoming each other. I don't really think a lot of people realize that, even though they say, yes, I understand that I could be able to welcome some. It's like people don't really take actions, they don't take steps in, you know, welcoming others. And so, and because of that, it creates a problem not just with a community, but it create problems, you know, outside, you know, it create problems in between, you know, race, it create problems between, you know, different backgrounds of people. And so Village Garden being in communities and letting that happen, you know, supporting communities, you know, realizing that we can work together was just, you know, really important stuff. I just want to close this real quick, I don't want to, you know, make this sound like, you know, I'm just speaking from the mouth, you know, everything that you guys have heard, you know, hear from here, like, you know, it's really going on, and, you know, the most important thing that I would love to see is, you know, to invite you guys to come out to the, you know, to these communities, to these sites, and, you know, check out what this, organization is doing, how is, you know, it's uniting a lot of cultures together, how, you know, we're growing vegetables, how, you know, we're supporting these low-income communities and stuff, and also taking that leadership in these communities and stuff. So please come and visit. It's important. Thank you.
We have a few photos to show you as well. We just wanted to click through. So much of what we do is really best expressed by getting to see some of the images of the season at the height of it. So I'll click through these really quickly if you want to mention it.
One of the things that I want to add that I think is so important, when you think about what can be accomplished, often we think that it takes large sums of money to really change communities and really help communities grow. For many years, this program operated on a budget that didn't even approach $300,000 a year. I think we've now grown to a little over $400,000 a year. But what this program is accomplishing in these communities really shows that with targeted dollars, working hand in hand with residents in communities around important issues, hunger, safety, community organizing, you can really change the faces of communities with really small amounts of money.
This is our FoodWorks farm and our garden club youth programs out with the teenagers on the farm. Some of our adult community leaders helping out at the youth farm. It's our new wash packout station. This is the very beginnings of the youth, the children's club garden in St. John's Woods. FoodWorks again. Our youth team this season did a delivery for a plate and pitchfork dinner that they were the growers for. This is in Seeds of Harmony in New Columbia.
Committees, anybody have any questions or comments? Representative Winger.
Just a quick question. I saw some drip irrigation lines. Are all the gardens watered that way through drip irrigation?
At the FoodWorks farm, we use mostly drip irrigation. There's some small micro sprinklers for some of their salad mixes that really do better with overhead watering. And the gardens, I believe, we have a combination of drip lines and hoses and little backyard sprinklers.
Thank you.
No question, Arjun.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the total acreage that you use again?
It's 1 acre.
It's 1 acre, and you mentioned your budget was $400,000 for the whole program.
For the entire program, which if you look at the community gardens and the farm, we have around 85,000 square feet of land in production. We also have an orchard in New Columbia as well. So I think we just submitted a recent grant this week, and I think the total operating budget is around $458,000 for the entire program. That covers the farm and the community garden sites, the children's gardens programs.
It also includes staff positions for up this last year, 22 youth and about 10 adults as well from the community.
It's not economically feasible for $400,000 for an acre, and that's not where the value is. The value is going to be in the education, the kids, and people who are participating in it that
right.
carry that through
right.
to adulthood, especially the young people. So,
yes, because this program is really built on a social determinants of health model that is really changing communities, not only from physical and mental health, but it's also addressing crime, it's addressing safety, it's addressing academic achievement. So there is a whole lot that goes on with this program beyond just the piece of growing food and improving people's diets.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
I've got 300-acre tree farm, and about a week after elk season, I'll be doing a pre-commercial thin. If anybody really wants to work.
Tell them where you live.
Yeah, go
it's just a very short drive.
So does, you know, in some areas in Salem we've had some problems at a school, and I read about in Portland a park. I mean, are people in the community very protective of the garden? Do you have issues with vandalism, or because there's so much involvement of people who live right there, it's a no-no to be messing with the garden?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, once you feel like you have a part in, you know, in stuff like that, you if you see someone trying to mess that up, you would, you know, step up and talk to them.
I think the other piece, the Housing Authority has been so impressed with the tenor of the communities of how they have changed since this program has gone into play and gone into operation. When we first started, I think it's fair to say when we started our program in St. John's Woods, the Housing Authority was not probably one of our most ardent supporters. Today, the Housing Authority cannot be more supportive of this program. And in fact, there is a community store that was part of the New Columbia development that is no longer in operation. And they have approached Janus Youth Programs in Village Gardens to come in and be the operator of the community store in New Columbia and are very willing to be very supportive of that opportunity. So I think for their role, they really see the difference that this program is making in communities around community cohesiveness and addressing a lot of the issues that they're working to address also in public housing developments.
How many markets do you sell at, farmers markets? I know you have your do you have a stand on Sovies Island, or is that used to put into the markets and CSA subscriptions?
We have a just a farm, and it's just at Sovies Island, but like we go to, I forgot the location, but it's we have our own stand at the farmer's market where we sell food to people who want it. And New Seasons is another place we sell food to. Produce to.
So they're selling at the PSU Farmer's Market downtown Portland, as well as the new St. John's Farmer's Market, which just opened this last season.
So, I mean, somebody's got to get up early and go down and set everything up and be ready when the market opens. That's responsibility there.
Someone who's done it.
Yeah, I've been there myself. Okay. I represent Wingard.
Thank you. Help me understand how you track your outcomes. Obviously, the point of the program is to make a difference in the community, I assume, on some specific rubrics, things like crime and maybe college attendance, or I mean, what are you using to try to track the effect of your program long term on the community?
So we have a couple of different evaluation plans that we use. We have an individual survey process that we do annually with all of the participants in the program. That's tools that were developed through the Community Food Projects assessment toolkit that comes through the USDA support kit for that funding. And so we ask folks questions around, you know, do they eat more fruits and vegetables because of their involvement? Are they able to deal with conflict without using violence or fighting better because of their involvement in the project? So there's a number of questions that really look to assess sort of individual impacts on people. We also have a partnership with PSU Regional Research Institute, and they help do some empowerment evaluations, so kind of group conversations and assessments of how the program is going and the impacts in the community that the program is having. So it's kind of a focus group model that we use. We're also developing some tools this season with the County Health Department through the Community Capacitation Center to assess health impacts both individually and on the community. So that's a project that we've just gotten funding to start working on. So we're still developing a lot of those tools. And a lot of the information we've gotten at this point is anecdotal and feedback we've gotten from partners in the community, housing managers who are supporting the housing projects. And so we're kind of working on some of those long-term impacts assessments for those larger indicators on the community systems.
We also have a grant through the Northwest Health Foundation to do some, which is a research grant also in looking at different aspects of the program as well.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, is PSU able to help you do any kind of a long-term study on your participants? And I mean, there's short-term effects, but obviously what you're really looking for is to find out if you made a permanent impact on somebody's life.
Yeah, so we are, what Rosalie mentioned, we have a planning grant to do a create a research plan based on a community participatory research model, and so that also is just starting, and we have some support within PSU to help us look at some of those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Van Orman, then we're going to move
on. In thinking in terms of longitudinal research on low-income families, having tried that years ago in Head Start, transitory families is a huge problem. And so I was curious if that's an experience that you have in the projects, that people tend to move frequently so that you have this constant turnover. Is that something you experience?
Do people move in and out so quickly that we don't have the same people involved, or how does that work in the neighborhood?
Well, with the kids, we mostly have the same kids, at least for a year or two or maybe more.
Okay.
But they always come back.
Regardless of whether or not they're living in the projects?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you find that people who live in the projects feel so much better about what they're involved in that they don't move to other places too, because you'd be leaving the garden itself?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. They got a few that's still there that have been there for years, and they still there.
Hey, I just want to say something. My name's Michelle Hannah, and due to personal circumstances, I came from a two-income household to basically nil because of personal divorce. And so me and my son, I learned about the housing program, so it was a great opportunity to have a home over my head, a house over my head, and so that's what housing is good for. And I grew up growing gardens with my mother in the community, and if it wasn't for this garden that I came to know about, I mean, it just helped me tremendously because of my income changed drastically. And I'm in housing right now until I get my feet back on the ground. And people, for the most part, they come and they are there. But, you know, it's such a community that it's like I want to, you know, better my life, of course. But I hate to leave because you meet these people. They're so diverse and awesome, and they're, you know, you learn so much and deal with problems and food. And, you know, I love walking in the store during the summer and say, ha ha, I don't have to buy you know, the tomatoes and lettuce. You know, but I'm saving money, and it's an awesome feeling. And you know, as far as being there, I enjoy it very much, and I don't know what my near future is going to be, but if I leave, you know, I'm going to miss it. And it's a great opportunity, and it's great food, great people, and it needs to be around the city more. And I it's really helped me and my son, and I appreciate it very much, and for these people, because they work together so much, and they listen to the community members. And I'm grateful for it, and I'm sure all of us are. It's a great system.
And I'm Patricia Brown, and I like to add to this whole picture of Village Garden. I went out there. I moved in St. John's Woods in 71, and it was so horribly bad with crime and violence and things. It scared me to death that I moved out within that year. I tried it again in 81. And the same thing. It was so horribly scary to me that I moved out again within that year. So I came back 2 years ago, and at this time, Village Garden was in motion and in fact already and planted, and they've been going on for 4 years. It's a beautiful world out there. The crime is so totally low, very low. It's not scary. I can walk through the neighborhoods in the dark, and I feel like I'm at home in peace. And I had my garden since April, and I didn't know anything about a garden. My health was so poor and so bad. I started working my garden. I started eating my produce and veggies out of my garden. My blood pressure used to be off the record scale. Now my blood pressure, since 82, now I have no high blood pressure. I'm healthy. I've lost a lot of weight. And I just
really give it to the community of Village Gardens. I love them there. They're good for the community. You can tell our kids who are working the Village Garden, you can see halos over their heads versus the kids who aren't involved. We got great people out there. And I really wish I would have known about the project 30 years ago when it started. I would have gave my career job up for it and did this. I'm volunteering now, and I found my niche, and I love it. And I wouldn't do nothing else in the world except for do this Village Garden with Janice program.
My name is Chai Thabo Songoro. I'm from Africa, in Central Africa, Congo. I'm in Oregon in 5 years now. I have 5 kids. I'm very excited to be in that community because I know that the importance of the community. The community is like a family. I'm on the Village Garden 2 years now. The first year I was working on my own. The second year I'm working as an advocacy on this garden. I'm so much excited because people can talk about something when they are together. And people can be together when they are on the table, and we can be on the table when we eat something. And because with that garden, people learn how to make something fresh, and people can come together with something. Genesis organized something like people come together, they can cook food. I think that is important. What we need now is like when we organize the community needed to be supported. The support with the community can come just on the head. And the head is we hope that that's help will come by what we do. Thank you.
Representative Robel.
Thank you very much. How many children are in the program each year, and how many volunteers? I mean, just the numbers of this.
Sure. So you all received a packet, too, so there's some of that information. Last year, we had over 100 children involved in the two garden kids clubs. This last season, we had 22 teenagers who were involved in the FoodWorks program at various levels of that project. We have 75 gardener families who garden with their whole family, so that represents a lot more than just a person, obviously. And we have probably about 20 to 30 adult leaders who are involved either in staff positions, volunteer positions, or are on the garden committees and the garden councils, which are sort of the community bodies that support and run the gardens.
Well, although we, I'm sure, would love to talk about this all day because it's a happy topic and not all of our topics are happy topics, but I'm going to ask us to move on so we can hear a little bit about what the Marion Polk Food Share is doing. But thanks so much. Some of you I met this summer, and I thought the committee would really enjoy getting to hear about what you're doing. It's clearly something that should happen in more places and is a very positive model for not only food security but community involvement and youth opportunity and adult opportunity. And so thanks. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
And then I'm going to ask Kim Hansen to come up from Marion Polk Food Share.
You're doing okay.
Yeah, we have a little extra time at the end before we figured we would go long, so we didn't try and ram one more item in before our break.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jordan Blake. I am the Garden Project Manager at Marion Polk Food Share. I've worked for Marion Polk Food Share for 4 years, going on 5. I was brought on board at first to be a warehouse assistant down at the warehouse where we do a lot of work. Before that, I was in AmeriCorps Vista up at Oregon Food Bank, Washington County Services, where I coordinated a 3/4-acre learning garden. It's a little bit of background on myself as the garden coordinator.
And I'm just wondering, will our presentation go up on the screens? Or
should.
It should? Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Great, thanks. And my name is Kim Hansen, and I work on primarily grants and strategic initiatives at Marion Polk
Food Share. And it's really an honor to be here today. Thank you for having us. And I've been involved actually with community food security and local food system planning really since the early 1990s. And I'm just really thrilled that you're addressing the issue of urban agriculture. I think there's so much potential to expand agriculture beyond the rural areas. And I know our land use planning program has kind of limited agriculture to more of a rural vision for it. But when we look at how our cities have been laid out, the majority of them are sitting on the most prime agricultural land. So there's really so much potential on vacant land to grow food and bring it closer to people. So I'm really happy that you're addressing this. And today we're going to talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about, very briefly, about Marion Pope Food Share and then focus on our sustainable community gardens program. And Jordan and I are going to kind of share that presentation. So Marion Pope Food Share, we're the nonprofit regional food bank. We serve Marion and Polk counties, and we're part of the statewide food bank network headed up by Oregon Food Bank. And our mission is leading the fight to end hunger in Marion and Polk counties, which is a pretty big mission at this point. As many of you know, probably just from hearing the news lately, we're really up against some pretty major challenges. I just heard on the news yesterday that Oregon's now the seventh highest for unemployment in the nation. Over the last 2 years, we've seen a 27% increase in need for food assistance. Last year, we distributed just in our two counties over 5 million pounds of food. In our two-county area, there's over 37,000 children eating a free or reduced lunch. So the numbers are high, and we're working hard on a daily basis to meet that short-term need, but at the same time, we're really focused on what are the long-term solutions to ending hunger and how are we going to address some of the root cause issues. And we really see community gardening as one of those major solutions for not only bringing in food to the food bank network, but also to the families who are in need of food for themselves. The vision of our garden program is pretty broad. It's to basically engage neighborhoods, schools, churches, prisons, and the entire community in utilizing available land to grow food for themselves and for those in need through our food bank network. We're really focused on education, improving nutrition, food production, increasing self-reliance, and strengthening community. And right now, we have one garden program manager who has this whole workload under him. And so what he's done, which I think is really incredible, is has basically gone out into the community and networked with numerous community partners to create our program. So right now our program includes Grow a Row, which is backyard gardeners or small farms growing some extra food for the food bank, as well as home gardens, community gardens, school gardens, church gardens, food production gardens, and our new Gold Star Youth Program. This map, our garden program actually started in 2006 with just three gardens, and we've now grown to 30 community garden projects in 2009. This year alone, we started 12 new garden partnership projects, and we have gardens in both Marion and Polk counties. This is an example of one of our church gardens, and this garden is out in Dallas, and this garden alone produced 10,000 pounds of food this year for families in need in the Dallas area. So it shows the potential. We have about 400 churches in our two-county area, and it shows the potential that if each church put in a garden, they could not only feed the families, you know, that participate in their church, but really contribute to reducing hunger in the community. This is represents three different garden projects. Up in the upper left corner, there's kids from McKinley Elementary School, the Roots and Shoots Garden Club that we help with planting out at the Pringle Creek community in Salem. And up in the upper right corner in the lower left, are participants from Hoover Elementary. Hoover is right now 80% of the kids at Hoover are on the free and reduced lunch program, and that's about 470 kids out of 570. The community resource coordinator at Hoover has been a terrific partner with us, and she helped us put together what we call the Garden to Kitchen program. And this year we worked with 30 families from Hoover Elementary
and 90% of them were Latino families. We provided toolkits for putting together a community garden bed. We taught them about potatoes primarily this year, the nutritional benefits of potatoes, how to grow potatoes, and did a four-week program with those families. And this is a picture of a few of our other garden projects. But on the bottom left corner is our Southeast Salem Neighborhood Association garden. And this project has just been a terrific community partnership for us. This is one of our most developed gardens. There's a tool shed you can see in the back. And slang in Spanish and English. We're working with a lot of Latino families in our community. So we tend to translate, you know, most of the garden materials and the classes that we're doing. This picture is just too cute not to include. This is Jordan's son, Otis, enjoying one of his first pea pods here. And we just really firmly believe at the food bank that it's not just about food assistance, but it's about good nutrition. And we're very focused on looking at what goes into our food boxes. And that's also one of the reasons we're focused on the community garden program, is we really want kids to be learning about good nutrition, learning where their food comes from, and starting to have good nutrition at a young age. So education is really the heart of our program. And we have several projects that I'm going to highlight. One is the Head Start to Garden program that we just started this year, right, Jordan?
We're starting this next year
with Community Action Head Start and the Marion County Health Department. And we're going to be working with a certain number of classrooms each year to work with the kids on learning about nutrition. They're going to grow vegetable starts, and they're going to plant those starts in some of the food share gardens. We're also working with WIC on providing outreach to WIC clients, giving them information about community gardening and connecting them with gardening resources. One big highlight is the start of our Gold Star Youth Gardening Program this year. We worked with more than 100 youth in four high-need neighborhoods in Northeast and Southeast Salem, and they worked with us for the whole growing season. They gardened, received nutrition education, and they grew more than 5,000 pounds of food for their families and the food bank network. And here's one of the really sweet little girls participating in that project, and some of the produce that we've grown at these gardens. And we just believe so strongly that community gardening and the food production that it provides really benefits the community. It not only plays a role in ending hunger, we actually were able, through all of our garden projects, to produce over 100,000 pounds of food this year. But even more importantly, the participants that are involved in our community garden program are experiencing increased food security. They're learning to grow food for themselves. We have an amazing story that was just in the paper that I attached at the back of your packets that are over there, about one woman who transformed the vacant lot behind her house with our help into a garden. And she did not need to access a food box this entire spring and summer. So that's the kind of outcome that we're really hoping for. The numbers just keep increasing for the food bank. But we really, really hope that through our community garden program that we can start driving that need down. And that's one of our major goals. Jordan's going to talk for a few minutes about several of our other program or garden projects.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to the point of community service and service learning and education, and really the transformational process that happens when you root a project in place. And a garden is a wonderful way of doing that. This is a picture of Oregon School for the Deaf, a back field that they own on their campus. And we had started a project, one of the first three gardens that we started back in 2006 was in partnership with Oregon School for the Deaf. And it was a very good partnership because we're neighbors, we're very close in proximity to one another. About a hop, skip, and a jump away from the food share warehouse where we base our operations. And this garden started out as a very small school garden. The teachers and the classrooms would come out, and they would tend their little plant starts in their greenhouse. They have a great greenhouse and a couple small little garden beds that they had grown. And the thing with school gardens is you know, come summertime, they pretty much get left to grow wild and survive if they can, if there's, you know, water getting to them. What we wanted to do was partner with Oregon School for the Deaf, bring in community volunteers to help them tend the garden, and it's become a pretty much full season, full year partnership where we work with them from the very beginning of the spring to, you know, getting the gardens put down for the winter. Last year we got the approval of this last summer to expand the garden out into about an acre and a half of their property out there towards Cherry Avenue. And we brought a lot of families out. We did a lot of gleaning. We get a lot of donations. I think one of the big things that I think both of our programs can talk to is the number of donations and the willingness of the community, both business, public and private sectors, to really put the pieces together to make it happen resourcefully. This is a garden actually that started the youth, actually the garden program in 2006 with a really robust kind of food production strategy as well as a community partnership with Marion County Corrections. This is the garden that started out on Almsville Highway in connection with the work center. They had basically in years past sent inmates out with weed eaters to mow down this field that was growing weeds and grass, and they thought that it would be a good idea to grow food for either Union Gospel Mission or Marion Polk Future. They connected with us. We had just started the idea of developing a comprehensive community garden program. We went out, helped them lay it out. They provided the labor and the water. We provided the resources and the guidance. And that first year, we grew about a two-acre garden and about 25,000 pounds of produce. Not to mention the wonderful experience that the inmates are receiving through hands-on, shoulder-to-shoulder work. We've have some really great success stories of these gentlemen getting onto a positive path, and we actually have a few work center people that are no longer in the work center working for Marion Polk Foodshare down at the warehouse. This is some harvest from our youth garden program that was a pilot this year. We started it with the idea that we wanted to offer a season-long experience in gardening and nutrition education and community building. So we started this as a after-school program at the end of the school year. Then it turned into a summer program where we met twice a week during the summer at our garden sites in the low-income neighborhoods. Some of these gardens are on church property. Some of these gardens are on school property. We're expanding this project into the next year, where we'll probably have about 8 sites. Just to talk to the keys to the program success, which are, you know, really working with community partners, empowering champions in our volunteers, focusing on that governing body, that community body of a citizen a council, basically. And a lot of our gardens are coordinated and managed via that way. And the grants and donations. I would like to say that I am one person, but we have a whole community that is behind the garden program. We have at one point last year, we had an AmeriCorps Vista that was an assistant. This year, we relied more on community volunteers. We do get a lot of support from the Marion County Work Center to help with the heavier duties. And it's all about being resourceful. And
okay. And I just wanted to add one thing about the partners is that the cities have been a tremendous help to us. The city of Salem, 3 of the community gardens, we've gotten support from the city with paying the water bill, which can be a big challenge. And they've also put in all the infrastructure for the water systems in the 3 gardens in Salem. And this year, they helped us expand from 80 to 160 garden plots in those 3 gardens. And now we have the cities of Woodburn, Kaiser, and Dallas also helping us. And so from a structural standpoint, the cities and the public works departments can be a real help to these projects, especially with the water bill for the lower-income participants. I just wanted to touch on a few other things that we're working on in terms of agriculture and food. One is that we just started a core food program at the food bank, which is the first in the nation, where we're focusing on having 12 core foods, nutritious foods, available at all times for our food boxes, rather than just taking whatever we get, which is kind of the historic food bank model. We're really focused on, we will still take whatever we can get, but we want to make sure that we have a certain amount of quality nutrition. So that involves some large-scale purchases from agricultural producers. Secondly, we're working on an agricultural land trust for the Mid-Willamette Valley in particular. We really see that we need to work on preserving farmland if there's going to be long-term community food security. So we're looking at how we will set that up, whether it will be part of the food bank or potentially its own 501c3. And through that, we hope to be able to provide more support to current and entry-level farmers, as well as have people cooperatively farm some of these parcels. We have a gift acceptance policy in place that we put in place recently where we can accept a donation of a farm. So we're hoping to have a food bank farm or maybe several in the near future, and that will produce food for the food bank but also be a place where we can provide some opportunity for some new farmers. And we're also really looking at increasing partnerships with the correction system. The correction system has a large amount of land and also a large labor pool for growing food, processing food. We're really exploring all the potential with that. And we're also looking at local food processing options, whether the food bank wants to get involved in setting up some kind of canning facility in our Mid-Valley community here, because one of the challenges we're up against is we can only distribute so much fresh produce, but then we get into how do we process it, and there's a limited number of options for that right now. And we've also just torn out our landscaping, and we're putting in edible landscaping. So pretty soon you can, and I would actually really welcome all of you to come out to the food bank, see what we're doing hands-on, and also tour our garden program. But yeah, so we're available for any questions you might have. I know you're running a little short on time at this point.
Got one burning question from anybody here. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
For coming in.
You're welcome.
I have a comment.
Okay. I have a question. One comment from Representative Van Roman.
Well, the interesting thing when you're talking about the work center, I can recall when Clackamas County had its own garden to feed its own inmates.
Mm-hmm.
Uh huh. Yeah. Marion County did that actually, but then there ended up being a couple snafus where, and I'm not sure if this is public record, but one of the deputies was selling the crop for a profit, personal profit. And that's what nixed that, I think.
Oh, I don't know what happened in Clackamas County, but I think
there's... Always one bad apple. Okay, so...
That's what it's
that was a pun.
Yeah, bad bean. So we're going to move into our farmer's market discussion and have first ODA, Lauren and Vance, come up and chat a little bit about ODA's perspective on markets and their activities this year. And then we're going to have a second panel and then open it up for public testimony. And there's at least one person here to testify during the public portion. If there's others, let our committee assistant know or raise your hand and we'll make sure we fit you in.
Welcome. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Vance Bybee, who is the Administrator of our Food Safety Division. Just as a little bit of segue before going to farmers markets, it's exciting from our department's perspective to see the community garden efforts in some of those. It's nice to see what some of our rural Oregonians already know already, which is what agriculture can do to a community and bring families together, and that movement into the urban sector, I think, is very exciting. We're here today to provide you with some information regarding the farmers markets in Oregon and to describe some of the challenges that we face as an agency in applying the rules and regulations regarding food safety in Oregon to those activities that are currently taking place in the markets. ODA's mission is threefold: food safety and consumer protection, protect the natural resource base, and marketing of agricultural products. Food safety and consumer protection and the marketing of the agricultural products is the two mission statements that closely, most closely align with the activities in the farmers markets. Our agricultural marketing division has spent quite a bit of time working with the markets and really, I think, have tried to help grow the markets either through a website presence or advertising market locations. But I think one of the highlights that our marketing division has done is been able to get federally funded dollars for the Farm Direct Sales program, for the WIC program, to help those folks as well as low-income seniors be able to use their coupons at the farmers, at a farmer stand or farmers market. That's been a very successful program. I believe Oregon's been one of the leaders in the nation in getting those dollars returned. And the last I'd heard, I think it was $1 million back into what would be farmers' pockets out of that. So that's been very successful. Other divisions like our weights and measures program also interface with the markets. The scales, anybody that is selling anything by weight, our division would have had some input and interaction with those scales, just like you do at a grocery store when you put produce on a scale. That serves two purposes. One, the accuracy of the scale is very important for both the consumer and I think the producer as well, to make sure that what is being purchased by weight is benefiting both and that no one's getting cheated on either side of that. Our food safety program is our agency's number one priority program. And it will be the focus of the rest of our discussion today. Our agency's first key performance measure is tied to the levels of compliance with the CDC's risk factors. Those risk factors are things like temperature, sanitation, cooking times, and things like that. Our strategy in our food safety program is to identify those risk factors that most likely are to cause illness, and then focus our staff efforts on education outreach and then trying to correct any problems that we might see. You may hear today from others some of the challenges that we have in carrying out our mission for food safety and consumer protection in the markets. I want to tell you today, and there has been some media attention on this subject, and I can't correct some of the misinformation out there today, don't have time, but one of the things that I want you to know is that the Oregon Department of Agriculture is very supportive of the farmers markets and want them to continue to grow and be successful. And at the same time, we feel kind of in a spot. We have a food code that was written several years ago that really doesn't fit the markets very well or the activities that are going on in the markets. The food code was written around, and our statutes were written around, food establishments, which are typically walls, ceilings, plumbing. You can imagine the challenge that that presents when you go to an outdoor setting like a market and how do you apply those. We did ask the Department of Justice to kind of give us a backstop and say, you know, are the markets really part of our statutory responsibility? And the answer was yes. They should be included in what you're doing with your food safety program. So we took that, and through a lot of conversation and seeing the markets grow, they've grown from, I think, 26 in 1996 to well over 100 today, and I'm assuming they're going to still continue to grow. We took that information and worked with the Oregon Farmers Markets Association to try to figure out how do we do this and at the same time not discourage their growth and put a damper on that and at the same time do what we think our food safety mission is, which is to reduce the likelihood of a foodborne illness. It would be a very sad day if a foodborne illness was linked to any part of Oregon agriculture, not just the farmers markets. I can tell you in other states that have had that happen, it has been a drastic outcome to not only people's pocketbooks, but the reputation, frankly, of our state. Our state, we are very proud of our Oregon agriculture and the quality of the products they produce. We're not concerned with farmers who bring fresh fruit and vegetables to the market. They don't need a license from us. They can go to those markets and sell those. The law today allows that. We're most concerned with the safe manufacturing and handling of processed foods. Things like salsa, barbecue sauces, canned fish, vegetables, all types of seafood, frozen and fresh and dried meats, cured meats, and all other kinds of processed foods, including canned goods, bakery, dairy, eggs. Those are the ones that are the most high-risk foods and the ones that can, if not handled properly, cause a foodborne illness. It's with all of those things in mind that we have continued to work with the Oregon Farmers Market Association to develop and publish guidance documents to ensure good handling practice and decrease the likelihood of a foodborne illness. The Oregon Farmers Market Association has been very helpful in helping us figure out what works and doesn't work in the market situation and has been a steady partner in helping us to develop our education and outreach efforts for market managers. Those guidance documents have been produced since 1999 and most recently our efforts in 2009. I now want to turn it over to Vance to have him describe in just a little more detail about what our food safety staff have done actually in the markets, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Vance Bybee. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to share with you some information regarding food safety. The Department of Agriculture is in a unique situation from many other state agencies in that besides having regulatory authority and the charge to regulate an industry, we also have the responsibility and the charge to perpetuate an industry and to support an industry. And so when we regulate at the Department of Agriculture, it's always through the lens of how is this regulation going to help promote agriculture or agribusiness, or how may it affect agriculture or agribusiness? Because it's, like I said, besides regulation, we also have the responsibility of promoting this very important industry for our state. Some of the ways that we have done that, Lauren has mentioned, is to read liberally the statutes that we have giving us authority to regulate and to license our facilities. Lauren had mentioned that we believe that we have authority, or that there's already authority in statute for farmers to sell their whole unprocessed commodities at a market. What the statute says is that there is farmers are exempt from licensing if they sell their whole produce on their farm. So what we have done is extend that, trying to promote agriculture and agribusiness. We have extended that exemption to farmers markets and said we'll allow farmers to take their produce to a farmers market as well off the farm and do that, even though that's not something that was contemplated by the statute. And there are other ways that we have done that as well, and that's one of the reasons why we think that it would be helpful to have some feedback so that we know that what we're doing is within our bounds of authority. Some other things that we have done to help promote is, as Lauren had mentioned as well, we've worked with farmers markets over the past decade or longer to establish guidelines to take farmers markets and kind of lift them out of the statutory scheme because they don't fit, but recognizing that it's important to have safe food available to public at farmers markets, we worked together then to establish guidelines that we thought developed some important food safety issues and at the same time gave farmers markets the freedom that they needed to sell their products at farmers markets. We have provided seasonal audits almost every year of farmers markets, walking through and just giving them tips, heads up, to let them know where we see food safety issues so that those vendors are selling healthy and wholesome food. And especially last year, 2009, we had a concentrated effort to go through the markets and have an educational program with the market managers and vendors along the issues of food safety. Let's see, we have also extended privileges of licensure at farmers markets to those who are going to bring $2,000 or less of food to sell, of non-potentially hazardous food to sell at farmers markets. The statute requires that all food establishments be licensed. It doesn't matter the value of what you're selling, and it doesn't even matter if you are selling it. The statutes include giving in the definition of sale of food, and so we have kind of extended ourselves there to allow for that, including the farm exemption that I mentioned earlier is an exemption for a farmer only. A farmer can take his or her product and sell it, that whole commodity. And that is as far as that exemption goes. But we've extended that exemption as well because we found that there were community booths and that we would actually be placing hardship on those community booths by saying it has to be the farmer to come and sell it. And so by allowing rotation, different farmers to take turns on different weekends to sell not only the farmer's produce but their neighbor's produce as well, we've reduced that hardship. And so that's something that we have done that extends our statute. Also, something that we have extended to farmers markets, which aren't allowed in retail stores, you have probably seen it's become quite not famous but infamous, the issue of dogs in retail markets. Every newspaper across the country picked up that story, including the New York Times. We never knew that it would become so popular. Animals are not allowed in retail establishments, period, unless they are a service animal. But because we recognize that there's a cultural difference at farmers markets, there are families who would be walking through their community and maybe just choosing to go through a market as they see it there on their walk, we said, well, let's allow dogs into the farmers markets, at least through the aisles, so that we're not limiting those who have access to farmers markets. So these are some of the ways that we are trying to help promote agriculture and small agribusiness through the Food Safety Division. In addition, just recently you should have, I believe you were given a copy of a brochure that we've published that we give to markets and to market vendors. We have
ours is all in Spanish.
Well,
there should be two versions, I think.
That's all right. Frutas frescas.
Yeah, entonces yo puedo dar mi testimonio.
Muy bien.
Okay. Nice. I'm good with that. I can go either way. Okay. I think we should have some English versions for you,
Don. Primary. Lauren.
Okay, we'll check for English versions.
No worries.
When you get your English version, what it will tell you inside is it's going to give you a graph to help you understand if you were coming to the market, whether you would need a license, whether you would need to be licensed or not, hand washing, how to do hand washing properly and how important that is, safe sampling designs, requirements for food labeling, especially with an emphasis on allergens, and the importance of temperature control, keeping hot food hot and cold food cold. Usually at a farmer's market, the challenge is keeping cold food cold. And
or hot
we
food hot.
Had no trouble keeping food hot at a farmer's market. In fact, cold food hot as well at farmer's markets. And then protecting from contamination, all sorts of contamination, whether it be environmental contamination, contamination from shoppers, or cross-contamination between the products that are at farmer's markets. We had an education campaign at the beginning of the market season, working with the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, and we began that by appearing at their annual conference to discuss farmers markets and the farmers market issues. And then with the help of the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, we developed our guidelines for this year, including the pamphlets that were distributed. And then we gave market and vendor education in 6 locations around the state. Let's see. Now, you might be interested in then, one other thing that we did as part of our 2009 campaign was we set a goal to visit 50% of the farmers markets to see how well our education and our efforts working with the Oregon Farmers Markets Association were doing. And we visited 51 markets, which is about 50%, because there's between 100 and, well, there's more than 100, because there are some that aren't participating with the, or aren't registered with the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, but we very nearly met our goal of 50%. Some of the things that we found when we were in the farmers market was temperature abuse of potentially hazardous food, which, as Lauren had mentioned, includes meat and seafood, eggs, and dairy products. We found temperature abuse in 39 of our 51 audits. We found 21 unlicensed vendors selling home canned goods, poultry, and sprouts, which are 3 of our, we consider, the most highly potentially hazardous foods. And one thing that I think that I kind of glossed over and neglected to explain is another extension that we have given to agribusiness is that if you are a licensed firm with the Food Safety Division and you want to sell at farmers markets, what we have said is that license that you have for your bricks and mortar firm, where you have a ceiling, floors, slope to drain, sinks, and all of those things. If you're licensed there and you're in good standing, then we're also going to extend that license to farmers market, and we're not going to license you there again. So when I say that we found 21 unlicensed vendors, that meant that there were 21 individuals there who were processing food that should be licensed with the Food Safety Division that weren't. And then we found 25 of our audits found that there were labeling issues, specifically that allergens weren't listed in labeling. One of the things that's important to note here is that what we were finding in farmers markets are very similar to what we find in our conduct of general business. When we go out to our industry, we are going to find some temperature abuse. About a week ago, I was up doing some inspections in the Portland area, and we found some sushi that was being held at 64 degrees at a very popular retail outlet. And so it's not just farmers markets where this happens or where we're concerned that it happens. We are informed 2 or 3 times a month at least. Somebody who is licensed will call us and say, you know what, my neighbor is selling food. I know that they're not licensed. And so we find out that they're not, and we'll go out and license that individual. And then we, because the FDA labeling requirements are fairly specific and sometimes complex, we often have the need to work with people on their labeling. Why is this important for us, especially now in farmers markets? It's because farmers markets are growing.
We need to conclude it here pretty quick.
Okay.
So
and I know we're not as fun as the local gardens.
It's true.
But it's we think that sometimes keeping people healthy might trump fun. But
I just trumping staying on time is good. You got 10 minutes and we're over.
And I will do that. Why it's important is because it's grown. Farmers markets have grown. The complexity of the food that you have in the marketplace has increased exponentially, and we're now inviting our high-risk segment of the population into farmers markets. With the WIC program and the senior coupon programs, you know, the children, pregnant women, and seniors are the ones who are at the highest risk. And so we need to protect them at the market as we would at Safeway, Fred Meyer, or anywhere else. You have, because we don't have a lot of time, if you have some questions, maybe I'll let you ask. We have provided you a handout of what other states are doing. Except for Arizona, Oregon is the only state that isn't currently formally regulating farmers markets. All other states, all of our western neighbors are regulating farmers markets. Some very stringently, others not as stringent. But I thought that might be helpful for you to get an idea of what is happening elsewhere. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. And I'm going to actually hold this off, and we will do questions after the second panel is gone, because I don't want to end up running out of time, since part of the whole point was to give these other folks a chance to talk. Concerned we're going to. And then we can have the department come back up to answer questions if it's necessary. So thank you for the initial presentation. The second panel is Kelly Street, Sarah Broderick, Ann Berblinger, and Rebecca Landis. Do we have four? Yeah, we have four chairs. Kelly, I've got you first on the piece of paper if you want to start us off.
All righty. Well, good morning, and I want to thank you for the opportunity of being here today. I'm Kelly Street, and I'm a nutrition consultant and urban farmer. I call myself up in the Portland metro area. I'm the proud mother of 300 layer hens. And I am speaking to you today as from the OFMA board, the Oregon Farmers Market Association board, as the issues and advisory chair. And what I'd like to do is, in the time that I have allotted, talk a little bit about who OFMA is, what our mission and goals are, and then jump into the public policy issues that we're working with ODA on, which you've already heard a lot of the nuts and bolts and the issues that we're grappling with. Anyway, the Oregon Farmers Market Association, we're a 501c6 nonprofit organization, and we're run by an all-volunteer board. And we are the leading organization that represents the majority of the farmers markets in the states. And as of this year, we had 92 member markets registered with the Oregon Farmers Market Association. And that included 11 new ones for the year of 2008. And it also represents over 1,000 agriculture and food-related vendors. And that includes produce, meats, eggs, cheese, ready-to-eat, and prepared foods. There's no nursery or crafters in that number of 1,000 vendors. Our mission is to strengthen farmers markets for the benefit of farmers, consumers, and the communities in which they reside. And so basically our three main goals are to provide educational opportunities and information, guidance and mentoring, and outreach and networking opportunities to the farmers markets and farmer growers for the purpose of creating sustainable direct marketplaces for locally grown and produced foods in our state. We also want to be a voice for the farmers market and support and advocate for fair regulatory public policies that affect small farmer growers and producers. And we also want to be a main promoting voice for farmers markets to the public and educate the consumers on the benefits of buying fresh and local foods and increase their knowledge and understanding of the farmers markets. So anyway, as you heard from Vance, moving on to some of our public policy issues that we have, we've been working together for the past several years. Actually, a lot of this work predates me. I've been on the advisory board for a couple of years and have learned a lot in that time period. The two of the most pressing issues which I have had the opportunity to work collaboratively with ODA on are how to legally define a farmer's market and then the issues of food safety that come out from that. And as you've already heard, there is no legal definition for a farmer's market in the state of Oregon. And historically, farmer's markets were farmer growers have engaged in direct marketing and selling of fresh produce to consumers. They have not had to be licensed as food establishments. But you've also heard that the variety of food items allowed in the markets has increased. And as you walk through your favorite farmer's market on any day of the week, you will find that it's not unusual to find a wide variety of processed foods, anything from jams, jellies, salsas, relishes, flavored oils and vinegars, dried beans, roasted nuts and baked goods, etc., alongside fresh, canned, and smoked meat, fish, poultry, and then you come to the raw produce in the farmers markets. Now, the customers state that they like the diverse market mix. The market managers say that it draws increased numbers of customers into the market, and the farmer growers and other small producers like that they can sell their value-added products directly to the customer and increasing their sales and lowering their administrative costs. And our organization of AFMA are seeking the support of both the legislature and ODA moving forward to allow our farmers markets to continue operating without having to be licensed as retail food establishments, but also being sensitive to the food safety issues as well. Because Oregon Farmers Market Association, we do understand that processed foods that as the numbers are allowed to, as the numbers are increasing and being allowed into the market, it does increase the potential food safety issues that may arise from that. But like ODA, our membership is committed to ensuring a safe food supply for the public. So what we would like to see regarding food safety regulations moving forward is that we focus on the sectors of the food system with the greatest risk profile using evidence-based research to guide us. Define and exempt from licensure those food products that are considered low-hazard foods, especially processed foods made from Oregon-grown foods, and to continue to encourage the free flow of direct farmer-to-consumer commerce to prevent negative consequences for the sustainability of farmers' markets in our state. And again, it's worth noting, and this is a good thing, that small direct marketing venues have not been implicated in any major foodborne incidences here in the state of Oregon. And again, you've already heard that we've been operating for the past several years under informal best practices that we have developed as a team with the Oregon Department of Ag, and these farmers market food safety guidelines have undergone a couple revisions, and the most recent was the one that we did earlier this year. The guidelines, we understand they're not perfect, and there have been some glitches regarding interpretation and implementation, but they have provided a means of communication between the Farmers Market Association and the Oregon Department of Ag. And so in closing, we would like to recommend that we revise the food safety guidelines for the market season based on the findings of the food inspection audits from this year, continue to provide training and technical assistance for farmers, market managers, farmer growers, and other small processors to help them apply the food safety guidelines and address the issues that Vance brought up around the temperature control, hand washing station sampling, proper labeling, etc. Help facilitate consumer community forums where farmer growers, small processors, and interested community members can provide ideas, comments, and concerns regarding food safety regulations, and continue to work cooperatively with ODA and be the voice for the farmers markets and communicate the ideas, comments, and concerns surrounding the regulation of food safety in the farmers markets throughout any new rule-making process that commences. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Who's next? Sarah.
Oh, my question.
Hi, everyone.
My name is Sarah Broderick, and I'm the market manager with the Hollywood Farmers Market. And this is my first season as market manager. I've been with the market since 2007. I started out coordinating the volunteer program and coordinating special events at the market. So when I had the opportunity to meet Representative Clem this summer, I didn't realize that he was the chair of this committee, and maybe I wouldn't have spoken as freely if I had known. I'm glad that I did speak as freely, though, and I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to be here today. So the Hollywood Farmers Market is a community-based neighborhood market. It's just finishing its 13th season. Our final market is this Saturday. We're all looking forward to a respite over the winter. In 1997, the Hollywood Farmers Market started out with 10 vendors. Today, we have over 65 vendors throughout the market season, weekly musicians, community booths, a thriving volunteer program, and many, many neighbors. We maintain a product mix, like Kelly said, as many markets do, that includes a diverse range of produce, different types of meat, dairy products, cheeses, nuts, nursery stock, cut flowers, hot ready-to-eat foods, and baked goods. And we have a little bit of everything at Hollywood and a very dedicated customer base. Our customers in Hollywood clearly want safe food and value farming practices that don't harm the environment while celebrating Oregon's agriculture. The mission of the Hollywood Farmers Market is to celebrate the bounty of Oregon agriculture through the operation of a community-based farmers market and other ventures that support small farmers and healthy urban neighborhoods. So our market has a strong set of vendor rules, and our vendors use common sense guidelines regarding food safety. This includes hand washing stations when sampling, maintaining safe temperatures for potentially hazardous foods, and storing product off the ground and away from potential sources of contamination. And I want to say that I think we're all working towards a safe and healthy food supply here, and I really appreciate the Oregon Department of Agriculture's attention to food safety at farmers markets. However, the ODA's 2009 market season information and guidelines, for me at least, were poorly timed and communicated, caused a flurry of discussion over email, a lot of confusion as we were getting ready to launch our 2009 season. The guidelines were still in draft form until about 2 weeks before our market opened on May 2nd. It would be helpful if guidelines were sent out well before the start of a market season so that we can take a look at what's changed, take a look at our own rules, and have the proper lead time to let our vendors know, you know, what changes are in store. There were a lot of questions around what's mandatory and what's not. There were a lot of what ifs and whys, especially around licensure, processed foods, and exemptions. We were asked to voluntarily comply with the guidelines that went above and beyond the kind of monitoring our market has done in the past, including providing periodic vendor lists to the ODA throughout the season and performing reviews of ODA licenses and maintaining records of our license reviews to provide to a food safety inspector upon request. We do require copies of licenses at the Hollywood Farmers Market. We keep copies on file with our vendor applications, but we've never been asked to hand this information over before or to perform our work in such a specific way. It drew questions at the board level and amongst vendors regarding market compliance and vendor rights. I had one vendor tell me that I was not allowed to hand over any of their information about their farm to the ODA and that they wouldn't speak to an ODA inspector if they came to the market without their attorney present. And so I want to reemphasize that we're all working towards a safe and healthy food supply. We're all interested in promoting Oregon's agriculture. But the presentation and tone of the 2009 market season information and guidelines didn't foster a healthy relationship or collaborative spirit with vendors and was instead seen by many as a directive from the ODA without any sort of dialogue available. Thanks to the hard work of Kelly Street and OFMA, the Oregon Farmers Market Association, we've been able to get a lot of our questions answered, although many still remain regarding jurisdiction, license review, and the legality of market compliance in providing vendor information to ODA without express permission of the farmer. Questions also remain around ODA definitions of processed food. It is very much concerning to me personally that ODA's definition of processed food essentially owns products like dried beans and cured garlic. I don't think that's the intention, but when you're looking at it in kind of a black and white framework, we have dried beans at our market, and I think that our customers appreciate being able to purchase those from local farms.
I do believe that farm direct and small scale food producers should be held accountable for the same level of food safety as larger industrial operations. Unfortunately, it often seems that the reverse isn't true. When we hear about unsafe food, it's most often about situations like the peanut recall of earlier this year. And when I asked the food safety inspector who came to my market about the intention behind the new interest in farmers markets, the peanut recall was continuously cited. The link between producer and consumer in this year's peanut recall is far more removed than that of a farm direct producer selling at a farmer's market. The peanut recall led to over 1,500 different products getting pulled from supermarket shelves, and there isn't even close to 1,500 different processed products at the Hollywood Farmers Market, let alone one producer that could have such an impact. Industrial food manufacturing and small-scale farmers and producers are like night and day when you compare their volume and their practices. The same levels of food safety must be maintained, but it doesn't seem that existing rules and regulations are scalable. To hold small farmers and small-scale food producers to the same standard of regulations as industrial food manufacturing isn't realistic. We need an approach to small farms and small-scale food producers that will help get new growers and small producers off the ground. We need an approach that is tailored to the realities of a small farm as a small business, trying to succeed in an increasingly harsh environment. As Ann Berblinger will talk about, Oregon's agriculture, especially that considered local, fresh, and seasonal, is an important and growing industry cluster. Supporting it, with the right support, this industry cluster can act as a basis for economic growth and give a competitive advantage to Oregon's agricultural products as we try to slow the rapid disappearance of fertile land and farming families across Oregon. So again, I just want to thank you all for having us here today and kind of starting this dialogue in a very public manner, because there's been a lot of stuff brewing in the background on the email list, and it's just great to get it all out in the open. Thank you.
Thanks, Ann.
Want me to go now? I have some PowerPoint slides.
Oh, okay.
I've got the little flash drive stuck in there. Do you want to go? Well, if you don't, why don't you talk while
we get that set up? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and do that, Rebecca?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today. I'm here today to speak for Corvallis Albany Farmers Markets, and as a former director and officer of the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, by the way, we are still members of OFMA, and I'm still a full participant. It was just time for me to move on and let some other people have some opportunities on the board. I've participated in regulatory matters with ODA Food Safety for more than a decade now. I started managing markets in 1995, but before that I worked here at the Legislative Assembly for the Department of Administrative Services and for Community Services Consortium in Corvallis. So just want to show you folks I'm not anti-government. As I write this, I was anticipating that we would hear that the parties want to work together to achieve a system of food safety regulation that keeps our customers healthy and without compromising the ability of farmers markets and small farms to grow and prosper. That's exactly what you've heard. That is what we all say we've been attempting for the past decade. From my perspective, we have an admirable track record on safety at farmers markets, but the regulatory relationship has had many ups and downs. A high point for me was co-authoring the 2003 Farmers Market Food Safety Guidelines with ODA staff. That document still resides on ODA's website, but as you've heard today, from various perspectives, it lacks a regulatory underpinning that gives the both of these parties a greater sense of security. For myself, as someone that keeps being involved in this, I personally want some assurance that I will not have to spend the next decade pushing the same boulder uphill, only to have it come down occasionally and flatten me. These periodic flare-ups impede my ability to run three farmers markets and breed distrust of government among our farmers. Now, I want to say I am an advocate also for ODA. At times, even when I'm a thorn in their side at others, I do tell my farmers that ODA has many functions that benefit us directly and indirectly, and I want to note that my farmers generally express support for the conduct of the ODA field safety staff, and I have a long track record for that. Various people have earned our trust. But at times in the not-too-distant past, we have had a difference of opinion with ODA Food Safety on statutory interpretation. our consistent position is that farmers' markets never, not for a nanosecond, own the food that is sold at market and thus should not be considered food establishments. It is no more appropriate to license CAFM, that's my nonprofit, or other market associations than it is to license the landlord for a Safeway where the company leases its building. Generally, the agency has expressed a desire not to license the markets themselves. But when we press them on regulatory or procedural issues, sometimes we're told that there might be an attorney general's opinion working against us remaining unlicensed. And Mr. Henderson made reference to a DOJ contact. This opinion is not a printed written opinion on the record that we can all look at on the web, and I would like them to either produce a written opinion for us or quit raising this. It's a tactic that is disturbing to me personally. And the timing of raising it is frequently what's the problem. I do believe it's possible to rewrite the closest applicable administrative rule, which is OAR 603-025-0030. By the way, a very poorly drafted thing. I think everyone in the room, if they read it, would agree that this is very poorly drafted, such that the entities that run farmers markets would continue not to be licensed and that farmers would not require an ODA food safety license unless they engage in processing activities that require it, at least under current law. Sampling is not processing by law if samples are free and small. If sampling remains a concern for ODA, I believe the most efficient and cost-effective approach would be to require a food handler's permit as a condition of exemption through an ODA administrative rule. And yes, I realize these are two different agencies, but I really don't think the counties are going to turn away this money. It's $15. You can do it in the middle of the night on the web. It's great. Speaking of the counties, I should note that our bifurcated system in which the ODA and the counties under DHS supervision handle different parts of the food safety puzzle is, well, puzzling to vendors. Some traditional food activities that occur easily in other states are hard to pull off here because they fall in the cracks between the two authorities. And some of these things might require statutory revision. One of our goals would be, I believe most of us would like to see some low-risk activities that are currently defined as food processing. Examples are roasting peppers or chestnuts. We'd like to see that able to happen at farmers markets, either through an exemption in the law. We have, as are some very less healthful products like cotton candy, for example, falls under the confectionery exemption. But at a minimum, we could create a low-cost variant on temporary restaurant licensing to cover these activities. So in my view, any administrative or statutory solution or solutions should achieve the following. One, to legalize farmers markets. Yes, I believe we're legal, but make it so that we don't have to keep dealing with these issues over and over and hearing that we may or may not be legal. Attempt to address direct marketing as a whole rather than just farmers markets. Farmers who sell directly on farm or other non-market venues should be treated similarly wherever possible. I should note that administrative rule I cited, it doesn't even serve the farmers on the farm that well, and certainly doesn't serve them if they move on to the next piece of property next to them that has a better frontage or something. There are a lot of holes in that OAR that are not good for all direct marketing farmers. I'm aware that any change would need to be revenue neutral. In other words, I'm not proposing something that would take a big chunk of this division's money away. Another caveat is that we will have to wrestle with some of the gray areas in direct marketing. Resale is not direct marketing, so that is not a gray area for me, but I believe there is a role in direct marketing for limited consignment, and it may not. My understanding of consignment may differ slightly with what Vance said, but that's something that we need to work on together. I work always to strengthen communication between food safety specialists and the businesses that they license. If ODA really would like some more data about our vendors, it should gather it through its own licensing applications and the direct interactions that it already has with our businesses. Or accept aggregate data that OFMA has compiled, and there are also academic studies. Whether we like it or not, farmers market managers do serve as ODA's eyes and ears on site, but we need to draw the line at collecting masses of data on ODA forms. It's not my job, for example, to help market ODA's new organic certification program, and that data was requested on the forms that they sent us this year. As Kelly and others have said, we need to observe basic risk management principles like spending the most effort where the risk is highest. ODA actually does practice this principle because it visits our vendors' production facilities less than annually when nothing is amiss. This fact probably was not considered in 2005 when the license fees were set. And I'm going to urge you not to buy any talk that you hear, either here in or in the national debate that's going on as we speak, about a microbe is a microbe regardless of business size. I agree with the prior testimony. The traceability and direct accountability do indeed protect our customers to a large degree. And if something goes wrong, it can be narrowed down quickly, unlike the national food crises that have played out over weeks and months. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our concerns. We look forward to your guidance regarding ways to advance the cause of farmers markets and other forms of direct marketing in Oregon.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca. All right, are we ready?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
My name is Ann Berblinger with my husband, Renee Berblinger. We own and farm Gales Meadow Farm in Gales Creek in western Washington County. I consider myself to have just about qualified as a beginner since this is our 10th season. I have a prior life, which overlapped to some extent, of 36 years of service as an economic development professional. Let me just add one more consideration to the good list that Rebecca had about why you need to worry less about directly marketed food than you do about processed food from agri-industry. We eat our food. If we have something for lunch on Thursday and it makes us sick, we're not even going to show up at the farmer's market on Friday, or Saturday, rather. You heard concerns and criticisms about the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Our own experience has not been negative. We have a scale license and a nursery license, both of which are affordable with a sliding scale of fees. Oregon Department of Agriculture staff have been professional, courteous, and friendly in carrying out their inspections related to our scale and our propagation of herbaceous plants, which means vegetable starts. But I've never had a meeting with ODA personnel with the purpose of helping our farm to be more productive, innovative, and profitable. ODA does not have an agenda of proactively supporting our part, the direct, fresh, local, seasonal part of Oregon agriculture. Fresh, local, and seasonal food is an important industry cluster in Oregon. It's a traded sector. We're replacing food that would otherwise be imported from outside. That not only includes fresh produce, but artisan cheeses, seafood, and other absolutely high-quality, wonderful products. It's a small but robust and growing cluster in which the supply is very far from meeting the demand. What a great industry I chose to become involved in. It includes meat, produce, seafood, and value-added products using locally produced foods marketed directly to consumers and chefs. Wine and microbrewing are widely recognized as important industry clusters, but fresh, local, seasonal produce is not. Now, I'm sure that you members of the committee are really familiar with the concept of industry clusters, but in case any people in the audience are not, an industry cluster, thank you, is a geographically bounded group of similar or related firms connected by common markets, often with especially sophisticated consumers, technologies, or knowledge. And they have also are linked to local suppliers, skilled workers, and supporting institutions. Economic success is not random. Similar and related industries draw advantage from proximity. And local preferences and knowledge clusters can be the basis for economic growth. And I really think, I know, that fresh, local, and seasonal food has that potential and has not reached its full potential yet. Supporting institutions for the fresh, local, seasonal food industry, we've got them. It includes certainly Oregon State Extension, Echo Trust, which was mentioned earlier today, the Chefs Collaborative, the Farmers Market Association, and every one of Oregon's many farmers markets, whether nonprofit or government supported. Thanks. And great local food contributes to the competitiveness of all of Oregon's industry clusters. Our knowledge economy depends on talented, creative people. Creative people are attracted to places with great amenities, and our food culture is nationally and internationally renowned. Local creative farms, which sell their food directly to restaurants and consumers, are crucial to our regional food culture, and farmers markets are absolutely central. So all of this in background is a reason why I would hope that the legislature gives direction to the Oregon Department of Agriculture to become more involved in promoting and supporting our part of Oregon agriculture, artisan farms, fresh, local, and seasonal food.
And we're going to have about a minute and a half for you.
All right. Well, I'm done. I've got one more.
All right.
There are some good opportunities, and one has been mentioned by most of the speakers here. A regulatory bike lane for non-hazardous value-added small farm products. The big hole in our business is between Christmas and about the end of March. We're not at markets then, and we sell very little to our chefs during that period of time. We could, if we had more opportunity to sell non-hazardous value-added products, start to really fill in that hole, and we could do more. We could be part of a movement where artisan farms collaborated, perhaps with the Chefs Collaborative and the culinary training programs in the state, to create a line of signature Oregon preserved foods and extend local foods throughout the winter season. Another great opportunity would be to help the markets with extended season and year-round markets, protected from the weather. We've just been having an email discussion of this on the Hollywood Farmers Market Board. There are year-round markets. We participate in one starting in March, which is Hillsdale. It's not that much fun to stand in the wind and the rain and the cold. It's not that much fun for us, and it's not that much fun for our customers. We do it because we love to be there, and we love our customers, and we're totally grateful for their intrepid behavior and showing up. Another great opportunity, and that was mentioned in the earlier urban agriculture discussion, is support for workforce development and the next generation of market farmers. We grow new farmers at Gales Meadow Farm. We're very proud of that. We'd love to get some help and support with that. And for more ideas on policy at the state and federal level to support farmers markets, I really want to recommend, if you haven't read it, the article Farmer in Chief by Michael Pollan, and I've attached a copy, which I will hand in. Thank you very much.
And we have, obviously this is a bigger issue, so I'm probably going to ask for people who want to serve on an additional work group to talk about implementing some of these ideas. I think that's ODA is interested in getting future guidance too, but we have one member of the public to testify too. So unless somebody has an absolutely burning question right now, I'd like to get this additional piece of testimony on the record.
It's burning, but I can wait. If you let me ask it sometime.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just Anthony Boutard, please.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak. For the record, my name is Anthony Boutard. I live in Gaston, Oregon. Our farm is a small, well-diversified farm. We produce grains, legumes, vegetables, cane fruit, table grapes, nuts, and stone fruit. We're one of a handful of market farms that is year-round. We sell at the Hillsdale Farmers Market in Representative Nolan's district all through the winter, formerly my neighborhood. I just want to add, it was nice to hear the kids this morning because all the adults, talking about community gardens. That's where I cut my teeth. My wife and I started in the community garden, Fulton Community Garden, and garden year-round. And I learned how to grow all through the winter. So when the opportunity came up to sell at Hillsdale all through the winter, I actually kind of like sitting around in the muck and the snow. It's a little bit more comfortable than 104 degrees, I assure you, at least for me, having grown up in New England.
As market farmers, we're often asked why it's so hard to find traditional local sort of farm-based foods in the state of Oregon. Things like brined pickles or prunes, raisins, that sort of thing, freshly milled grains, whole grains even. And our reply is the Oregon Department of Agriculture makes it hard for small growers like myself to produce these foods. The requirements are really established for large processors. They're not designed for a small farm like ours. We work sort of off the edge of things. We don't have a dedicated facility necessarily. Currently under the regulations, I have a dog in the house, so I cannot have it. According to the Department of Ag, when we've talked to them, if you have a dog in the house, no domestic kitchen license. So even for anything that didn't involve canning or something, still no domestic kitchen license. That's out. There's things, rules like that, that make it very, very difficult, and the license fees are pretty high, and so when you sort of calculate things in the back of your mind, and you've got something that may make bring into family or to the farm income $3,000, and you're paying a $500 or $200 license, you balk at it. You just go, I'm not going to put that money up front. I'm taking the risk on the crop. I'm taking a whole bunch of risks. And even though I'm trained as a forester, even though farming is a shorter rotation, the risks are substantially higher, and you've got to, you know, you've got the seasons and it's things. Oregon's strict land use laws are predicated on the productive use of the state's farm and forest lands. The underlying justification for protecting the farm is the flow of economic and social benefits that the land preservation brings. Family farms such as ours should be preserved for our day-to-day contribution to the state's economy, not just as quaint footnotes, historical footnotes, or horse farms. It is not enough for the state to restrict development on farm and forest land if our ability to generate income from the land is curtailed. Traditionally, farmers have bolstered farm income by processing some of their crops. Walnut and prune dryers were a common sight in the valley. Decades ago, dozens of roadside stands sold prunes, pies, pickles, preserves prepared by farm families. As licensing fees and other requirements have put a chill on modern farmers' ability to add value to the crops, these farm-based foods have disappeared. Sadly, it is hard to find a true Oregon prune anywhere in the state, and I'll add that it's the best prune in the world. And we produce them on our farm for our own use. I'd like to be able to produce them for my customers. A lot of these laws are an artifact of the last three decades when almost every farm sold the majority of their crops to food processors. The food laws are written to regulate large industrial processors. Consequently, few farmers really paid heed to those laws. As processors have folded or abandoned Oregon, farm income is being pinched. And in my case, my farm originally had five different contracts. Three of the companies that they had contracts with are either bankrupt or out of the state and no longer doing business. Seinfeld Pickles, AgriPac, and Simon's Food, and there's one other. Oh, Smucker's as well. So you can see that shift. We're having the ground pulled out from under us. So we're being boxed into doing additional processing or value added. Good models for change exist. Many states have adopted a light regulatory touch when it comes to on-farm processing of low-hazard foods, and you've heard this before, such as pies, pickles, preserves, dried fruits, dried herbs, lacto-fermented foods, ground grains. New York and Iowa have a long tradition of encouraging traditional encouraging farmers to offer those foods directly to the public without costly inspections and license fees. Minnesota's 2004 pickle law permits farmers to produce a variety of value-added foods without running afoul of the state food processing laws. Likewise, this spring, Indiana followed suit with its pie law, freeing pickles, preserves, and baked goods from heavy regulation when sold directly to the customer. These laws are carefully limited to direct sales to the consumer, not third-party sales. It's not a free-for-all, and all products have labeling requirements, including a list of ingredients and a statement that the goods are not produced in an inspected and licensed facility. They simply remove a substantial barrier to expanding food operations. Progressive states treat on-farm value-added products as one would treat a bicycle versus a Mack truck. You've always seen the bicycle lane analogy. It's a good one. It does not make sense to require bicyclists to wear seat belts and pass commercial driver's licenses, driver license exam. Likewise, a farm family that bakes a few pies, grinds some cornmeal, or ferments a few batches of sauerkraut to sell to regular customers should not be subject to the same laws as a mill grinding tons of corn per day or a processor producing thousands of jars of sauerkraut an hour. These are foods that have been safely prepared by farmers for generations. We need to reinvigorate that tradition rather than stifling it with further regulation. And I just want to stress, I'm talking about direct sales here. So I'm talking about the full universe of direct sales. There are buyers clubs, there are CSAs, there are direct sales to restaurants and the farmers market. All of them are what I call farm gate type sales. There's no intermediary. And the person who's buying it can evaluate, see my hands are clean, they have a relationship, and if something goes wrong, they know I've eaten it, as I think Ann said. You know, we eat our food. We grow it, we eat it, we rely on it. So that ends my comments. I also want to say I'm not against regulation. I comply with scale laws, with the Organic Food Act. I'm certified organic. OSHA restrictions because I have a registered labor camp. But I want the regulations to be sensible and to achieve a public purpose and not to impede my business. And that's what I'm asking for. I appreciate the opportunity to comment, and I'll disappear. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we clearly have a lot of work to do in this area.
We do.
Yeah. And ODA acknowledges completely, as you heard in the beginning, that some of our statutes don't necessarily address size at all. And so I'm not going to do a whole bunch of additional work right now because we've got other topics and other people and somebody on video conferencing here in a second. But I would like, I've got Representative Wingers interested. Representative Krieger?
No.
Anybody else want to serve on a work group related to this topic?
I would.
Yeah.
Work group, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Krieger, Van Orman, myself, and Wingard then. So that's four. That's enough. Otherwise, we'll have a quorum of the committee. So we have members sitting out in the audience. We have one person who wants to testify. Would you be willing to send us an email, and I'll make sure that everybody reads it?
I swear to you, a minute is enough for me to tell you what I need to do.
Okay, while we're getting the other people in here, you can come up and give you your 60 seconds. Start with identifying yourself when you get here, though, and you want to start bringing the other members in. We're going to all slide down.
Hello, thank you for giving me a minute. My name's Chrissy Mannion Zarpour with my husband. I own Cuculon Farms in Yamhill, Oregon. We are the largest small poultry producer in Oregon. So we sell raw whole chickens at farmers markets and a few other places. Arguably a hazardous product. We are licensed. ODA, in fact, came and took photographs of our poultry processing plant for the purpose of training their inspectors on what a good plant looks like. We are at least one order of magnitude larger than anybody else processing chickens in Oregon now that Foster Farms has moved to Washington. I just want you to understand how small a small farm is. Diestel Chickens, which is one of our local regional brands, processes about 35,000 chickens a day. They're very small for a chicken processor. Tyson, Purdue, the big ones, process 250,000 chickens a day. In 2008, my farm processed 16,000 chickens in a year. In 2009, we processed 4,000 chickens for the year. Delivering just was too big a hassle. I'm an order of magnitude. In 2008, I was an order of magnitude larger than any of the other small farms. There are, I believe, 8 processing chickens in Oregon today. And we're talking about tiny, tiny volumes.
We are going to have a discussion. Maybe we'll fold it into this work group, but we had a proposal from Oregon State yesterday about some just on the issue of fresh chicken processing and exemption potentially the way some other states do it for, I think it's less than 1,000 birds.
Many states do it that way.
Yeah. Thank you for your input. And we're going to bring our other people in. If members want to take your break while they're coming in, you're welcome to.
While he's here, just one quick comment. Representative Krieger suggested that Mr. Boutard might be an excellent member of your work group. And while he's here, I wanted to ask if he might be willing to participate.
Yes, I would love to.
And I think we probably want to ask Sarah and Rebecca, too, while they're here before they escape.
Could I have my question?
Yes, right, your burning question. I'm sorry.
My burning question. Well, what Rebecca, I think, brought it up in her testimony, which has been, I've been sitting here trying to figure it out myself, is the role of the public health department at the local counties and the Department of Agriculture. I can tell you right now, Hood River County is in an absolute uproar over potlucks. They have just put pretty much everybody out of business in potlucks. So in this discussion of food safety, you know, I am not clear who really is responsible for what. And I think there's an overlap, there's a gap. Somehow, I don't know if it's bigger than what we're looking
well,
at.
Well, for example, if I got it right from our conversation yesterday, at farmers markets, the stands that are food-related and serving foods that have been prepared, and like crepes or somebody's serving lemonade, those are regulated. Those particular stalls are regulated by the public health department. But the other stalls are regulated by ODA. So all in the same market, you've got, you know, depending on which stall it is, you've got a different agency regulating the activity.
But that would be the only time that you have that sorting out of who's responsible for what?
Oh, I doubt it. Lauren, you want to come up real quick?
Sorry.
It's okay.
I need a cup of coffee, too.
Representative Van Orman, for the most part, the statute actually talks about how we separate our duties.
Okay.
The simplest way to think about it is anything restaurant-like is public health. Everything else is pretty much the Department of Ag. I can't answer your question on the potlucks. That puzzles me just a little bit myself. But
apparently it's a health thing.
Yeah, public health works with the county health departments to provide oversight to restaurants, and then we're everything else, grocery stores and those things.
Okay. All right.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
So where are we supposed to be sitting?
Yeah, we're going to recess for a moment while we get the room resituated.
Okay.
Mind moving?
Good morning. We're going to reconvene the Senate Natural Resources Committee. And thank you for having us here, Mr. Chair.
You bet. And I will bring the House Committee out of recess as well. And demand silence from Representative Gilliam, who has not said a word all day. It's really quite shocking. Because I was the one responsible for us running late, I get to handle the first portion of chaperoning this next hearing, and then we're going to alternate to Senator Dingfelder for the Wolf and back and forth until we finish. And we have on the television screen there a guest from Washington State who is available to us on video conferencing, which is, I think, the first time I've been involved in one here in the hearing room, so it's kind of exciting.
Oh,
and then we've got, oh yeah, then after Robert speaks to us a little bit, then Kurt Melcher from the department is going to talk to us here in person. And we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers, but I assume it's probably Dr. Wiglis is my guess, but I don't know that for a fact. So welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So do you want to talk to us a little bit about the work you've been doing and what you found, and then maybe be available for some questions?
Yeah, sure. We've been studying cougars here in Washington State. I started in 1997, and I'm summarizing this stuff through 2009. So we've been looking at for 12 years, we radio monitored about 150 cougars and their prey in three separate study areas up in the far northeast of Washington in the Selkirk Mountains. Then we moved to Kettle Falls in north central Washington, and then at the same time we studied them in central Washington at Cleo. And the reason we started all this, the cougar research, was up in the far north in the Selkirk Mountains. And what we were having was a declining mule deer population and a declining endangered mountain caribou, the last remaining mountain caribou population in the lower 48. And we were wondering, why are these sensitive mule deer and endangered caribou going down? And we studied those animals and found that, in fact, cougar predation was the biggest factor for the decline of both of those species. And we published that paper in the Journal of Wildlife Management back in 2002. And we said that, well, okay, yeah, the cougars are indeed eating a whole lot of mule deer, and they were primarily responsible for the decline of mountain caribou at the same time. Now, while this was happening, cougar complaints started to rise. We started increasing the harvest of cougars in that area, in northern Washington, and the majority of northern Idaho, and a really good hunk of southern British Columbia. So this is a very large region where cougar hunting has increased dramatically. And what we found was that as the increase in cougar hunting was going on, the numbers of complaints registered by, you know, ranchers and livestock operators and just the general public, and actually some attacks on human beings were increasing. And so the feeling was that, well, the cougar population must be increasing to reflect the, you know, the high predation on mule deer, mountain caribou, the high incident reports, livestock depredations, all this kind of thing. So we radio collared a bunch of the cougars, about 50 of them, to find out if in fact that population was increasing dramatically, and the densities were very high, as everyone had supposed, and as what we thought at the same time. Now, after we radio monitored them for a number of years, about 5 years or so, and the complaints and all the problems were still increasing, we found that actually that cougar population was not increasing. In fact, the extremely heavy hunting over this 30,000 square kilometer area, again in Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia, was causing a 20% decline in the cougar population over time. So the cougar population was actually declining very, very steeply at the same time that the complaints in livestock depredations and predation on millionaire caribou was increasing, which seems very counterintuitive. And we looked at these cougars by monitoring their survival, their maternity rates. We did independent censuses of the population. And both all of these methods showed that the cougar population was, in fact, declining. What we did notice was that the cougar population, the age structure was extremely young. It was comprised mostly of teenage cougars. And we couldn't really find any four-year-old or older males. Typically in a cougar population, you would find a number of five-year-olds, six-year-olds, seven-year-olds, eight-year-olds. They go up to about 10 years of age. And we couldn't find any of these older resident adults, and all we had were these young teenagers. And previous work by others have shown that these teenage cougars, particularly teenage males, tend to be immigrants coming from elsewhere. And so we thought, well, maybe the problems that we're encountering, you know, with increased livestock depredations and complaints at any rate is because, you know, the vast majority of the population was comprised of teenage males. And it could be that, you know, that was causing the problem. We published that paper in the Journal of Wildlife Management in 2006, and I believe copies of these papers have been made available to you. I sent them to one of your representatives. So after we did this work and published this work in the suburbs, we concluded that increasing complaints and depredations and so on are not consistent with an increasing population. As a matter of fact, the population could be declining. That it was declining because of heavy hunting. We suspected that immigration was contributing to the high numbers of teenagers in that population. We then moved to some other study areas to see if, in fact, the heavy hunting results in increased immigration by teenage cougars. And in Kettle Falls, we instituted, again, the complaints were high, depredations were high, and we instituted a heavy hunting regime, again, to try to reduce the complaints. And what we found was, as we predicted previously, this is, again, about radio monitoring 50 animals, but as we killed the resident adult cougars, we found compensatory immigration. And so males from really far away, perhaps British Columbia and Montana, we've seen cougars move from our study areas to Montana and vice versa. And so these young males were coming in, and the heavy hunting in that case was not reducing the cougar overall numbers at all. The densities remained static over time. The difference was that it was a shift, the sex age structure shifted to young teenage males. And again, we had none of the resident older adults there. And this big influx, about 15% per year, of teenage males coming from vast distances away and repopulating that area. So the heavy hunting did not result in the expected population decline in game management unit 105 in that region. Now, at the same time, we were looking at a lightly hunted population, and what would be expected there was that the population would be growing, and some people thought that, well, perhaps we should start hunting cougars at a higher rate in Clear Elm to prevent cougar numbers from increasing. And but the hunting regime was quite light there. And we documented them. We monitored about 50 calves in the fall, again with radio monitoring and annual censuses and so on. And we found the exact reverse that we found in Kettle Falls. That population was not increasing as well. The densities remained static in that care management unit. And the difference was that there was immigration. So the teenage males were leaving, basically, from Cleveland and going elsewhere. And so both the heavily hunted population and the lightly hunted population had similar densities, and the hunting didn't affect the densities at all. All it did was cause a immigration response with mostly teenage males in the heavily hunted population. And in the lightly hunted population, of course, the age structure was much older, with a lot of older resident males and older females and so on. But there wasn't that expected increase in cougar numbers that people would anticipate. So what we said then, and we published that paper, that was published in Ecological Applications in 2008. And then in 2009, we published another paper in Animal Conservation. So the one paper was on Kettle Falls and the other was on Cleella. And then most recently, in 2009, just this October in Ecology, we compared the two populations, the heavily hunted and the lightly hunted one. And what we found was that the immigration response, the heavy hunting, removing these resident adult males, resulted in teenagers coming into the populations. And what happens is that these new males that are coming in are sexually mature, but of course they're not the fathers of any of the cubs in that population, you know, because they're new and they're coming in. And the females only breed about every 2 years or so, and they maintain the cubs with them for a period of time. So what happens is that, much like in African lions, these immigrant males then were coming in and attempting to kill the kittens of the females. And we found that there was a high incidence of what we call sexually selected infanticide in the hunted population. So a large number of kittens were being killed by these immigrant males as they come into the system. And in the lightly hunted population, of course, the animals that were there, the male animals were the fathers of cubs, and when they weren't killing any of the cubs, we found no infanticide there at all. And so what we found, again, was that the heavy hunting impacts the female component of the population. It doesn't really do anything to the males because of immigration, but it impacts the female component because some females are killed, and a large number of kittens were also being killed. And so the female component of the population under heavy hunting declines, and the male component of the population increases. And we see this infanticide occurring. Now going back to predation on sensitive mule deer and endangered mountain caribou, we did find that in three study areas, in Selkirk Mountains, Kettle Falls, and Republic, that mule deer were declining because of cougar predation. And we couldn't quite figure out why cougars would select for low-density mule deer at high elevations when there was an abundance, a superabundance of white-tailed deer at low elevations, so more than enough prey. Why would they go up to where there's scarce prey and prey on these scarce animals like endangered caribou and mule deer? We, after looking at the infanticide angle, then we decided to see, well, let's see exactly which type of cougar is preying on rare mule deer and endangered caribou. And what we found was that the cougars that are selecting for the mule deer, the low-density prey, were females with kittens. The male cougars, females without kittens and so on, were not preying on these sensitive prey animals. They were staying at low elevations and eating abundant white-tailed deer. But because the females with kittens, the kittens were vulnerable to this infanticide by immigrant males, And those females with young kittens would then move up into high elevation areas where they normally wouldn't live, and they would subsist on declining mule deer and declining mountain caribou. So what we found, and we're just submitting that paper to ecology in about 2 weeks, my colleagues in the WDFW are just making final revisions on that, is that the high hunting that we imposed to reduce predation on declining secondary prey was actually causing the high predation on declining secondary prey. The heavy hunting resulted in an influx of males. The females with kittens then moved to low-density secondary prey and started killing them at high rates, and normally they wouldn't do that. And we suspect that the same thing was happening with our endangered mountain caribou. Now that we go back and look at our data sets, it looks like females were primarily responsible, and it was females with kittens. And again, why else would they select for these rare animals? So what we found there was that, well, okay, it appears that the heavy hunting actually isn't reducing predation on these valuable and threatened game species, but it was actually increasing the predation because of females with kittens moving to those low-density prey. At the same time, then, looking at things like livestock depredation and complaints, we just finished this analysis, and that paper will be submitted within the next month or two. We found that the heavily hunted populations, when the immigrant males come in, their home range size is double what it normally would be. And the home range overlap, and that's the overlap between different males, is also double than what we found in Cleone. So the stable, the lightly hunted Cleone population had this stable home range structure with territorial males, adult males, keeping other cougars out. The heavily hunted population had the adult males being removed, that new immigrant males would come in, and the new immigrant males would have larger home ranges because there's no territorial males left, and they basically stack on top of one another. And what we interpret with that is the increasing complaints that appears in livestock depredations is because the home range sizes have doubled. So each livestock operator now, instead of dealing with one cougar, is dealing with two or more. And so what we have is this increased numbers of young male cougars stacking up, and the encounter probabilities between human beings and cougars actually increasing rather than decreasing as a result of the heavy hunting. And so we have this unstable home range structure under the heavy hunting regime. As the cougars mature, they get shocked, and then new immigrant males come in, and it's constantly in flux. And you end up with teenage males who are basically running around all over the place, and you bump into way more than you normally would in Cleone. Our livestock and complaint rates, the lightly hunted population, the heavily hunted population had five times as many complaints and eight times as many livestock depredations. However, the density of cougars was the same, the density of livestock, the density of humans, the density of prey, everything else was the same. The only difference was the age structure. The heavily hunted population was comprised of mostly teenagers, and the lightly hunted population was comprised mostly of adult males. So it appears now, and we're just finishing this analysis, that the heavy hunting results in this unstable home range, doubling or tripling of encounter probabilities between cougars and humans and cougars and livestock. And, it's unanticipated. I don't think anyone has looked at the cougars the way we have, really ever before, and our results are really quite surprising. But this is what we're finding here in Washington State. Some of the other perhaps interesting things that we're analyzing now, and we don't have the answers yet, is that are these immigrant males, do they tend to behave more aggressively towards humans? Do they hang out at human habitations more? Do they behave differently towards livestock than resident males? Other researchers have suggested that that's the case, but we're confirming that right now to see if, in addition to the increased encounters between humans and cougars, that the behavior of these teenage males is more aggressive than resident adults. And so that's where we're at right now. Basically, a summation is that when we started this work 12 years ago, everything that we kind of thought about the effects of hunting has been 180 degrees different than what we initially perceived. That we thought that hunting would reduce predation. We thought that it would reduce cougar-human conflicts. We thought that it would reduce a whole bunch of problems. And in fact, it appears that the heavy hunting was actually exacerbating all of those problems and indeed causing them to begin with. The heavy hunting that caused these complaints and depredations and predation rates and so on to increase. And so we're suggesting in our papers at any rate that agencies might wish to consider looking at what the actual effects are. A close scientific examination of the effects of hunting cougars, and we encourage others to replicate our studies and see if that's occurring elsewhere. But our typical management strategies looked like they were causing more problems than they were solving. Here in Washington State, some laws and regulations have been changed, and indeed we're reducing our harvest of cougars in an adaptive management way to see if that will actually reduce complaints and depredations and predation, because the other methods have not worked. And so that's pretty much where we stand right now. It's exciting work. It's very different, probably quite controversial, as you might guess. However, in defense of the work, I would say that that it is all being published in top-tier scientific journals. In ecology, it's gone through peer review. And again, this is the most intensive and extensive research on cougars that I'm aware of that's been conducted anywhere. And in terms of theory, the results really aren't surprising. If you look at how cougars behave, or leopards, or tigers, or any of those animals, all of these things would be predicted to occur. It's simply that we were managing cougars in the past as if they were traditional game animals like deer or elk, and their behaviors are completely different, and hence their response to hunting is completely different than deer or elk. And that would be a summary, a verbal summary of what we found. If you like, I could give you a PowerPoint presentation. I could leave that till later and open it up for questions right now. I know I gave a quick summary, some probably dense scientific topics, and perhaps someone would want me to clarify some points.
Yeah, thank you, Doctor. I think we will take some questions now. I'm going to ask if there's any House members. I know we've got at least one Senate member with some questions. So, House members with questions or comments initially? Representative Buckley, and then come to Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor, for the information. Obviously, in the populations that are not heavily hunted, what happens to the teenage males in those populations? Do they migrate out because there's an older male already existing, or what is the impact of the teenage males in the lightly hunted populations?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They either migrate out of the population, and they succumb to natural mortality. Adult males, resident adult males, would typically kill these teenage males, a large number of them at any rate, and so they tend to meet their demise at the hands of other cougars. But they will leave the area. They will try to find uninhabited areas, if they can find a region where there isn't a resident adult male, then they will settle in and take that area, and that's exactly what we saw in the Kettle Falls heavily hunted population.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, Oregon Cougar Management Plan does have some information now after being in place for a few years, and I believe it's our intent to send you the information that we have if you've not already received it. Will you be able to look over the information on the Oregon Cougar Management Plan and respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to do that. I haven't received anything. I'm unaware of whatever Oregon has plans or for cougar management. I don't know what's happening in Oregon. But if OVFW wants to send me their proposed management schemes, I would be more than happy to comment on them and help them in whatever way that I could.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Figure.
Yeah, thank you for your information. I kind of wondered if you could clarify about the issue of the area where dogs were allowed and the percent of success and what part of that population did they take off compared to the area where they did not use dogs, because without using dogs, normally the percent of take is extremely low.
Well, what happened here in Washington State, where we didn't have hound hunting, we had what's called boot hunting, and it was anticipated that that the harvest rates would decrease with boot hunting, but it looks like they actually increased because the number of permits went up dramatically. For example, we may have had something like, I don't know the exact numbers, but it was on the order of 600 hound hunting permits, and it went up to something like 20,000 or more combined boot hunting permits. And this is where you buy a package and you get a deer tag and an elk tag and you get a cougar tag, and so the harvest rates of cougars under boot hunting actually went up, and we've been harvesting a lot of animals under that regime. And in some cases now, again, like in Kettle Falls, we're reducing, the WDFW is reducing the number of boot hunters and trying to reestablish the hound hunting regime. But, I personally feel that the hound hunting was more easily regulated, more well regulated, and, it worked well. We didn't have any problems, prior to getting rid of hound hunting. The folks that wanted to, I don't know if I should even say, folks who wanted to get rid of hound hunting thought they were doing cougars a favor, and I've always told them that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And as we had hound hunting, everything seemed to be fine, and with losing hound hunting, that's when the big severe problems started occurring. And it's because the harvest rates actually increased dramatically.
Okay, I'm going to hand it over to the Senate for a few questions.
Hey, Senator Boquist has a question.
Yeah, Doctor, I'm intrigued by the immigration and immigration issue, the both in and the out issue. Can you expand a little bit on that? I mean, you suggested that, obviously because of radio collaring, you've had cougars immigrate or emigrate as far away as British Columbia and Montana. You mentioned not knowing anything about Oregon, so I'm curious, how do they know where to go or where they're going to go? That's the first thing. If you've got any indication of that, some sort of ability, I'd say this, to communicate, because they're obviously not just stumbling around. And then why have you not seen, you say you don't know anything about Oregon, why would they not immigrate south to Oregon or to another location? Is it just a scientific geographic area they're operating in British Columbia, northern Idaho, Montana, and northern Washington, or is it a larger area? Is the thesis it's a larger area and we could get your cougars coming to us, or you could get our cougars going to you?
Yeah, these animals, they're migrating about 100, 200 miles, that type of thing. We've seen the movement between British Columbia, Idaho, Montana, and Washington because our work was done in northern Washington. I have no doubt that cougars are moving between Oregon and Washington State, and between Oregon and Idaho. They move vast distances. And so what we have is a source sink dynamics. It's very difficult to manage on a game management unit basis and say that, well, we're going to do this on this game management unit because the things that are happening far away from that game management unit will result, animals will come in or animals will leave from a game management unit to one that's very far away. And it looks like their movements are random, indeed random. They just simply strike out once they reach about 2 years of age. Off they go, and they just start traveling. And as long, and they'll keep going until they're killed by a resident adult or until they find an uninhabited, unoccupied range.
Okay, we have a follow-up question from Senator Boquist as well.
Dr. Phillip, have you found any method or have any theories or theses, whatever, on how to prevent the deprivation of the young males, basically the cubs? Because what you're talking about here is the new males are coming in or the immigrants are coming in and driving the females out of their range into higher ranges. And of course, the females are going to protect it. Have you come up with any techniques or ideas on how do you prevent those females from being driven out of existing ranges into other ranges so that they of course, protect their cubs?
Yeah, sure. In Clee Ellum, where the hunting regimes are much lighter, most of the adult males still remain. The fathers of the cubs are there. And so the females with cubs don't migrate up into higher elevations or human-occupied areas to avoid these males. They live in the same region where the prey abundance is high. So we don't have any of this female with kittens avoiding males in the lightly hunted population. They're simply not going to avoid fathers of their cubs. It's just when you kill the resident fathers that the non-fathers move in, and of course they're infanticidal, but the fathers themselves aren't. We saw no infanticide at all, no sexual segregation by females moving into different areas in Clee Ellum where the hunting is light. So in order to prevent things like infanticide, and prevent females with cubs moving into either low-density prey areas or perhaps human-occupied areas to avoid infanticidal males, we simply say, don't kill the males. If the resident males are there, the females live with them and they live with them quite happily.
I think we have one more follow-up question, then we're going to ask, I think, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up, so I hope you can stay on the line.
Sure.
Just a follow-up, Doctor. I'm trying to make sure I understand here. What your theory, the theory or the thesis is that the immigrant males are less aggressive and not as strong as the older males in the area, so therefore they're not challenging them out of their territory. That's the basic concept you just explained to me. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The older resident adult males are very territorial and they're highly successful in keeping other males out of their home ranges.
Right, obviously that's the fittest thing here doesn't work out here.
So should we ask the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up? Representative
Klein? Any more questions from the House then? Maybe I'll just ask one while Kurt's making his way up. At one point in Oregon, we were down to like 200 cougars. So obviously, if you hunt heavily enough, you solve the young male problem as well. So not advocating to go back to 200 cougars, but it seems like there's, it can't be a never-ending supply of cougars coming in from other places. Eventually, you harvest enough that you have a balance between the deer population and the remaining living cougar population. Or at least that's what our history of 50 years tells us versus our history of, the last 16 or whatever. Well, no, it's more than that now. It's almost it's 15 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you hunt them heavily on a very large scale, like we did in the Selkirk Mountains, 30,000 square kilometers, that will, because you're killing the animals that are immigrating in, even, and it's such a large area that the core area, there's no immigrants left, basically, but what you have to do then is hunt them over very large regions rather than a game management unit. It has to be looked at, you know, like what we found, on the order of 30,000 square kilometers. Then you can affect the population reduction. And in fact, that's what happened in the Selkirk Mountains. And we did get a population reduction there because of the heavy hunting was occurring over a very wide area. And we eventually did get a reduction in predation on Mount Caribou and Mule Deer. And the reason for that was we got rid of most of the females, and most of the females were kidding. And so when there was hardly any females left, avoiding these infanticidal males, then the predation on those endangered species declined. So indeed, you can reduce problems, I suppose, predation, perhaps depredation complaints, so I haven't seen evidence for that, but you can do it if you heavily hunt them over very, very large regions and reduce them to very, very low density.
Well, thank you, Doctor. If you would like to stay on, we have Kurt Melcher from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife here, and I'm sure there's going to be some more questions that come up. So if you can hang on for a few more minutes. We're running a little short of time, so we're going to have to speed it up. But if I may, you've got your presentation here, Kurt, which I was going to say is sort of your dog and pony show, but I could say your cougar and wolf show. But if you could, I think it would be really interesting to hear if ODF&W, or I don't know if OSU has been doing any similar research, or if you've looked at the research that WSU has come out with, and any thoughts or reflections on that, if you're seeing similar trends here in Oregon and all. And I know you're going to talk a little bit about that, but we were just talking about how one of the things we don't have is an integrated, I mean, Washington has their strategy, we have our strategy, yet cougars don't necessarily, like wolves, stop at the border. And looking at some type of integration of management plans is also something you might want to talk about, but you can get started.
Okay, thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm Deputy Director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me here today Dr. Dwayne Jackson. He's one of our principal wildlife researchers in Oregon. And I won't, because we are behind on time, I won't go through this testimony in great detail. I will go through and highlight some key points that I wanted to emphasize, I guess, to the committee members here today, and then certainly happy to answer additional questions, come back before the committee or whatever is your desire, one-on-one or in group format. So just I wanted to mention our cougar management plan. We did adopt the plan in December 2005. The commission adopted that plan. An important part of that plan is an adaptive management strategy. We have proceeded with some adaptive management implementation over the last 3 years and found and are prepared and have reported on some results. Have a detailed, essentially 40-page report on results of our first 3 years of implementation. Happy to provide those to any committee members that may be interested electronically or in hard copy, whichever the preference is. But in implementing our three cougar target areas, beginning in 2006, we identified three specific goals that we wanted, or objectives that we wanted to meet. We selected a target area to address human safety / pet conflict concerns. That target area was Jackson County in Southern Oregon. We identified the Beulah Wildlife Management Unit over in Eastern Central Oregon, I guess I would say, that because we had a large number of livestock depredation events as well as livestock depredation complaints. And we also identified the Heppner Wildlife Management Unit. We'd seen that Heppner Wildlife Management Unit, just as a matter of background, is one of the real workhorse elk production areas in the state of Oregon. Highly productive elk herds over the years, and since the mid-1990s, we've observed much lower productivity, calf ratios in that unit, calf to cow ratios in that unit, which is our primary measure of elk productivity, had declined from typically over 30 animals, 30 calves per 100 cows, to the range of 15 to 19 calves per 100 cows over the last decade. And that was attributed largely to cougar predation. So we identified those three target areas 3 years ago, and we proceeded with a program to administratively remove a set number of cougars from those areas. And we did that over the last 3 years, and then have reported and prepared our results. I think Dr. Wilgus mentioned that when they had done these removals, they saw actually the opposite effect. It increased complaints, increased predation. We actually, in two of the three areas, we saw very positive benefits. So, for instance, and I'll just, and again, I'm going very quickly here, so I apologize if I'm leaving out too many details, but in the Beulah Wildlife Management Unit, we saw livestock depredation complaints and cougars that were removed for livestock depredation issues declined by about half after we went in and administratively removed cougars annually, 12 cougars net in that unit annually. And we also established control areas with these, so we were not just measuring in a vacuum what happened in a given wildlife management unit. We had, in the case of Beulah study, we had the Malheur unit, which was our control. We did no treatment in that area. Livestock complaints and depredation events essentially stayed the same. They did not decline, whereas in the area where we treated, we saw great reduction in both complaints and in cougars that were killed as a result of livestock depredation. In the Heppner Wildlife Management Unit, which was, again, the one where we were looking at whether we could influence calf-to-cow ratios and influence elk productivity, which is a direct benefit to the hunting community and, of course, the rural communities of Oregon that rely on those activities, we went in. We had a target of, I believe, removing 24 cougars per year. We did not achieve the 24, but we were close to that each year. We measured calf survival in the Heppner unit, and calf survival increased 76% after the 3 years of treatment. Compared to our control unit, which was the Ukiah unit, immediately south of Heppner, very similar in terms of elk productivity, in terms of habitat, very similar control unit. We observed no improvement in calf survival in that unit. So in those two units, for those two purposes, we did see what we believe to be meaningful benefits. In the Jackson County target area, where we were looking to whether we could minimize or human safety complaints and or pet conflicts, those would be pets that succumbed to cougar, we did not have any effect on the number of complaints or the number of cougars that were removed as a result of those complaints. And in looking at the Jackson County target area, we had a very difficult time achieving our objective of removing very many cougars. The land management, land ownership patterns there are comparatively speaking, relatively small private ownerships. It's very difficult to get enough permission to pursue cougars with hounds across multiple land ownerships. And similarly, it's difficult to use traps in areas where you have a number of domestic pets, for instance. So we were not able to achieve our objective of removing very many cougars in that area, and likewise, we saw no effect on the number of complaints or the number of cougars that were killed as a result of conflict with humans or pets. Hunting remains, and I don't want, you know, we've talking here today about the Cougar Management Plan or about our implementation of target areas. Hunting remains a very important part of cougar management and cougar management history in Oregon. I did not mention yet, but in 1967, cougars were removed from the predatory animal classification to the game mammal classification, largely a result of requests from hunters and conservationists. Cougar management has been truly a success story in Oregon. We went from approximately 200 animals in the mid-1960s to 1994 levels. We estimated that there were 3,000 cougars in the state of Oregon. That was pre-Measure 18, which banned the use of hounds to hunt cougars. Since that time, we continued to evaluate and assess the population, and we now, as of 2008, have a cougar population in Oregon of 5,700 animals. With that, Chair Dingfeld or Chair Clem, happy to answer any specific questions.
Okay, we have, I'll start with Senator Boquist, because I think these continue on his line of questioning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kurt, I got a question for you, and then I have a question for it's Dr. Jackson, right? Age of the administrative removed cougars. Are we talking in similar to the thesis theory from the state of Washington that are these younger cougars that are actually removing? The second question that I'd like the doctor to follow up to is the immigration theory. I mean, we've seen a boom in the cougar population very quickly, and I'm wondering in his studies here in Oregon whether the immigration theory could contribute to that boom. Are we getting Northern Californians coming in not paying taxes and Nevadans crossing the border and so on and so forth?
Sure. Chair Dingfeld, Senator Boquist, as far as age structure in our cougar removals, both the administrative removals and those removed as a result of hunting or as a result of take by, for instance, Wildlife Services as a result of depredation events, has been very diverse. And we've had a broad range of age classes, not focusing only on young age cats. In fact, we believe we have a very in the field, a very diverse age structured population. We've gathered that information, a very long history with that information. All hunters have to check their cougars in to us. We do collect that information, and we see a very broad age structure. Similarly, that is also the case with regard to females in the harvest, and based on the proportion of females and the age structures in the harvest, we believe we have very low exploitation rates on these populations, both on a unit-wide basis as well as on a statewide basis. And Dr. Jackson may have something else he wants to say on that, or
immigration theory.
Immigration theory, thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist. For the record, my name is Dwayne Jackson, the research project supervisor out of Roseburg. To answer your question succinctly, I guess, we've got, and one of the advantages of being a researcher is that we get to have competing theories, competing hypotheses. And in the research that we've been conducting in southwestern Oregon, I agree that there's a lot of immigration out of areas. It's not necessarily associated with heavy harvest in our particular areas. We have been looking at a study area that was about 200 square miles in area, and we had 30-some individuals migrate out of that area. Out of those individuals that migrated, every single male that migrated from that area ended up dying from some other reason before it reached a age maturity for sexual maturity to impact the population. And so in those particular situations, the theory in which you might create a vacuum, I agree, there is a possibility for that. The populations that we have had here in Oregon, at least in some of the areas that we're looking at, don't necessarily fall along with that same theoretical basis. All right, thank you.
All right, other questions from senators? I just had a quick one about habitat, because I really haven't heard much about habitat and how much do impacts on habitat, I'm thinking especially in southern Oregon and central Oregon, have on our population. Their populations are growing, and in some areas of the state, the habitat is probably shrinking. So I don't know if you've been tracking as far as how much impact that has on the fact that there's been human encroachment in areas that have been traditional cougar habitat.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, certainly that's an issue for all wildlife species, not just with regard to cougars. And as we move into these areas, we're going to have more encounters. That's a given. I think more importantly from our perspective, though, is the abundance and the growing abundance, essentially doubling over the last 15 years, increasing from 200 in the 1960s to close to 6,000 now. If you have the luxury of talking to someone who hunted in Oregon or spent a lot of time in the woods in Oregon in the 1950s or the 1960s, someone who worked in the woods, spent a lot of time out there, they never saw cougars.
That's right.
And you can talk to those same people now, and it's a common occurrence. The densities are much higher now than they were, and that's a big factor in the conflict.
Okay, Representative.
Yep. Representative Krieger and then Winger.
Kurt, as you said, from 64, and I was with the State Police Game Division down there, up until 91, I saw two cougars in that whole time. And that was a lot of time out on foot, sitting, watching. They just weren't there. Since that time, I don't know how many. So it, definitely when the population came up. The other thing, we're talking about this migration. I doubt that many of them are going to come south from Washington to Oregon until you get clear to the east side. So you got 200 miles of river. They're not going to swim across. We have a little body of water called the Pacific Ocean. They're not going to come from there. So when I look at Curry County, which is right on the California border, and the huge population of cougar we've got down there, they are coming north, and they're probably coming maybe from the east, I don't know, Ashland, over that way, your area. But that population, maybe you could describe what you, or if you know, how that cougar population has affected the blacktail population, because down in my country, Southern Coos, Curry, that population of blacktail, like on my tree farm, if it's 5 to 10% of the animals that I had 15, 20 years ago, I would be surprised. We go months without seeing a deer, more elk, of course. And just the other day, I was out on the tree farm, and I did see cougar tracks right with the elk tracks. So they are definitely having an effect on the elk, which maybe to some degree down there, we don't want that population to get too high, but definitely it's a negative on blacktail.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, we have not initiated any cougar-specific predation, depredation studies in Western Oregon as it relates to blacktail deer. And certainly, I think as the committee, I know we discussed many times during the session, there's a number of factors contributing to declines in blacktail deer populations, and you know, the lack of early stage successional habitat is a big one. Certainly predation, I'm sure, is a contributing factor, but the short answer is no, we have not initiated any specific studies on that, at least not that I'm aware of, and Dwayne's shaking his head no as well.
Representative Wingert, and then to Reblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kurt, can you give the committee some idea of what the department believes the average growth rate is of this population? I mean, you've got 5,700 of them. You know, how many per 100 do they attend? You gave one for the elk herd.
Sure.
Earlier.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingert, we do model the population size annually, and I believe that we've been seeing an annual population growth of it's in around the 5% range. And I'll look to Dwayne. It's in that neighborhood. It certainly varies from year to year, but it is in the 5% range. Certainly on a statewide basis, that would be. And certainly when there was 200 animals, I think it was the growth rate was much faster. And then as we've reached larger numbers, there's some depensation, there's some compensation, you know, going on with regard, and we've heard testimony about that with regard to densities and what cougars do to other cougars when they infringe upon their territory.
So if the hunting levels are somewhere in that range of 200 to 250, is it your expectation then that you're currently keeping the cougar population level? Because I'm seeing a chart that shows it continuing to grow.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingert, that percentage growth is after all the other sources of mortality. So that's after hunters had harvested a couple hundred per year. That's after a couple hundred per year were removed as a result of wildlife or other complaints. So if there were none of those, then, and assuming there was no other population-related interaction, then the growth rate would be higher than 5%.
So I'm clear. We have roughly 5,700 cougars in this state right now, and you believe that roughly, we're adding 250 additional cougars to this state every year.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingert, that I would say, doing the math here, that's about accurate. That's what we've observed over the last 15 years.
Okay, one last question.
I need to get Roblin in, and the chair over here is yanking my plug.
One last question.
Can you ask him offline?
Really would like to have this discussion
super quick
in public. What does the department have any number that they believe is an appropriate, sustainable level for cougars, whether it's more or less than what we're currently experiencing?
Chair Clem, Representative Winger, in the cougar management plan, we essentially established a minimum level of the abundance statewide of equivalent to the 1994 population size, which was about 3,000 animals. And then we established four additional objectives to minimize all those objectives essentially were to minimize various forms of conflict and to manage cougars to meet our big game population objectives. Where the number falls, as long as it's above 3,000, is fine, as long as we're achieving the other objectives of minimizing those conflicts and achieving our big game.
So you believe 3,000 is a healthy level?
We got to get.
Yeah, Representative Wynne, I'd really highly recommend, if you haven't, to read the Cougar Management Plan, because many of us who have worked on it for many, many years, a lot of these questions are actually answered in there. But I'd encourage you to meet with, maybe you can do a briefing offline with the representative.
Okay.
I'll have a question, and kind of from everything I've read, including the Cougar Management Plan, we look at 9,000 as the kind of the maximum holding capacity for cougars in Oregon, given the total number of square miles and so on. And we're approaching that number. As we get closer, nature usually takes over, regardless of what's happening, and disease happens. Are we finding in these overpopulated areas where we assume the population, Southern Oregon is a good example, are we finding disease coming in the cougar population?
Chair Clem, Representative Roland, not that I'm aware of, but I'm going to defer to Dwayne on that specific question.
Chair Clem, Representative Roland. Actually, in the research area that I was working in, we actually had a documented increase in the amount of mortality associated with diseases and parasites in the population. And by the time the study was completed, after 10 years, diseases and parasites and infanticide were the two highest causes of mortality in that population.
Because I just follow up real quick, because I was hearing that there was a wasting disease in some of the cougars in the Roseburg down to Coos Bay region.
I wouldn't actually call it a wasting disease.
Okay.
They had internal parasites that were perforating the stomach lining, and it gets pretty ugly after that. But to answer your question, there was an increase in the number of individuals that were dying from diseases and parasites on the study area. And that occurred as the densities increased fairly dramatically on the study area.
So my final, just has to do with that same thing. So if we can manage the population, it appears that the disease does not enter in as quickly as when we are not managing that number.
That would be the assumption.
Okay.
Should we transition to wolves? Okay. Kurt, we have you up here. I don't know if you're going to stay on. Dr. Weigas, we're transitioning to wolves, which you're welcome also to stay on for. But I will ask you, Kurt, we are running behind, and I'd like to wrap this up by 11:30 so we can leave time for the 20-year buildable supply discussion. And my presentation can be reduced to 2 minutes, so I can defer some of mine for make sure.
Chair Dingfeld, Chair Clem, I will be very brief. You have some additional details here in the written testimony. I'll just give you quickly a brief update on the listing status. So wolves in eastern Oregon were delisted last May 4th. That delisting is currently the subject of some litigation. Right now they stand as delisted, and we're staying tuned to see how things play out in federal court. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is being sued over that delisting decision. So stay tuned for more details, but currently they are delisted in eastern Oregon. A big factor in the delisting and including Oregon in that delisting decision was the fact that we had a wolf management plan. The federal government did not delist wolves in Wyoming because they felt they had an inadequate plan. So our state plan was a key point in that decision to include us in the delisting. We I wanted to give you also a quick update. We do now know and have confirmed that we have at least two packs. We've confirmed two packs in Oregon. We certainly have many, many more wolves that have been either reported, legitimate or good, solid reports, or and or documented by our staff. And most recently here, just last week, in fact, our staff, my wolf staff of one, he's the wolf coordinator, the wolf outreach person, he's the wolf biologist and the wolf field technician, did in fact confirm that a wolf that's been referred to as B300, it has a collar, it's a collared wolf, female, B300, has had at least six pups and is with a pack of 10 wolves now in the Imnaha drainage in northeast Oregon. And that was just yesterday. A little update during the session. We had a lot of discussion, of course, around wolves and a particular pair of wolves in the Keating Valley that had moved in, killed a number of sheep and other livestock. Those wolves were essentially hazed and left the Keating Valley, spent the entire summer up in the National Forest and, in fact, in the wilderness area. And then in late August, they returned to the Keating Valley and killed a number of livestock again. We did, in fact, trap those wolves back in the spring and actually had one of them collared, so we knew it was the same two. In late August, in following the terms of our wolf plan, we did issue the permit to essentially kill those two wolves. And U.S. Department of Agriculture Wildlife Services staff did, I believe on September 5th, find those two wolves, and they were killed. Which is a big part of our plan. We're following the plan, and I think it's important, obviously, that we do so. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about, I mentioned that I have a wolf staff of one. He's funded with the State Wildlife Grant, which is a federal fund that is matched with our non-game checkoff dollars from our non-game checkoff on the tax return form. With the passage of House Bill 3089 last session, classifying wolves as now a game mammal as opposed to a non-game mammal, it does provide us some flexibility to use other staff to work on wolves and on wolf depredation issues in particular. And we have now had at least some of our district staff did assist with the Keating Valley incident as a result of that legislative change. Prior to that legislative change, we keep a very distinct wall, if you will, between the use of hunting license dollars on non-game species. It's not something we generally do. So with the passage of that bill has provided some additional flexibility, and we did enter into a small contract with the USDA to actually conduct the removal activities over in northeast Oregon last August and September. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Can we start with questions on the House side, Representative?
No questions. We're good.
On this side, any questions?
Back on schedule.
Okay.
Is that short enough?
Yeah.
Happy to come back and chat with you individually or together.
I'm sure there'll be some other questions.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Representative, I guess
okay.
We'll move on. And I wanted to say thank you to Dr. Wilkes, because we really appreciate your presentation. I'm certainly looking forward to reading these papers that you've sent to us. And if you could email us the PowerPoint, I think we'll make sure that all the committee members get a copy of that.
Can you hear me still?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, one thing I just might add, the apparent discrepancy between effects of hunting in Washington and Oregon, maybe simply because what we call lightly hunted or heavily hunted is lightly hunted. We're looking at 11% mortality rate, and we had no problems with that. It's just when we were getting up to a 24 to a 30-something percent hunting mortality rate that we saw these exacerbated problems by hunting. So it could simply be that when I'm talking about you know, lightly hunted, you people refer to that as heavily hunted. That could be the discrepancy there, as well as scale. And one final thing is careful on the density. What we found is with the radio-colored stuff is that traditional methods were overestimating cougar densities by a factor of 2 to 3 because the trapping areas or whatever are much smaller than the home ranges of animals. And that's basically, we were overestimating cougar densities by 2 in limited populations and by a factor of 3 in heavily. So one has to be aware of that.
Great. Well, we appreciate your observations and your thoughtful research, and we'll look forward to, as I said, reading through the papers, and we may want to invite you back for future hearings.
Yes, sir.
Representative?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move into the history of the 20-year buildable land supply requirement, and so many people I've got here. Why don't we get all four of you up at once? We've got four chairs. So Bob, Sid, Sean, and John.
We actually were going to ask you about cougars and wolves, but we decided we'd talk to you about land use instead.
Taylor's got some opinions,
yeah.
I'm sure. I know Sean does.
Recipes, too.
Save those for later.
He always does. He's good. Okay.
He's a stand-up comic in this one.
Bob, how about you get us started?
Thank you, Chair Clement, Chair Dingfelder, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What I'm having passed out here is just some brief notes, and I'm not going to go through all of these. In fact, I presume there's more points I could make about this than I'd have time. I want to emphasize that when we're talking about a history of this nature, something that was decided between 1974 and 1979, I wasn't with the program for several years after that, and the data that one would look to research this history, most of it is not digitized, it's not searchable, so it's real hard to do this research. And I was able to contact people who were around when these things were decided to sort of set me on the trail here, and unfortunately that's the way that I was able to do this in the amount of time I had. I presume you could go into our files and find this if you had hours and hours, but I don't have that. So with that caveat, I outlined at the top of this what I believe were the three questions I was asked to answer here. What's the history of the 20-year supply? What was its purpose? What were we trying to accomplish? And does the policy still make sense today? So in the first section there, I've indicated that 1974 Goal 14, adopted with 13 other statewide planning goals in 1974, established the requirement that all cities plan for an urban growth boundary that is long range and that separates the urbanizable land in that city from the farmland and forest land outside. For a number of years, there was no 20-year supply. There was nothing in Goal 14 at the time that said anything about that number. And it's my understanding from the history that indeed what promulgated LCDC to eventually land on and assert a number, that is 20 years, was in part a number of cities that were preparing land use plans in that time period, submitting them to the state for approval under the statewide goals, and were frustrated with the lack of clarity on some of this terminology, and that's something that's happened throughout the land use program. To the extent LCDC has a general vague standard that gives a lot of flexibility, there's always pushback from the other side, from often local governments who want more clarity. So what I could find in the record is that by 1979, at least in the written record, LCDC had pretty much landed on a 20-year supply. My suspicion is there was a lot before that. It's not in the record. And that in order to arrive at that number, LCDC looked at several things. First, there was a number of cities coming in, interpreting that number, and offering plans to LCDC for review, and those local interpretations in many cases, were 20 years. It was fairly standard for population forecasts that were used for planning then and much, many, many years prior for planners in many states and Oregon also to use about a 20-year planning period. But LCDC was also in a balancing role. There was, of course, testimony on all of these plan reviews about the concern that the land supply inside urban growth boundaries would be too large, and that would have the effect of, or perhaps no effect, as a control of sprawl or other purposes. And there was certainly concern that if that supply was too small. And both of those considerations were involved in LCDC's making this decision. I also have to emphasize that Senate Bill 100 and the statutes that led up to this process required counties to, and still do, required counties to come up with a population forecast and to coordinate the population forecasts of all the cities in that particular county. And back then and still today, that's a 20-year forecast. When we talk about the amount of land in an urban growth boundary or what that land supply is, it's pretty meaningless unless we're also talking about the density and the efficiency of land use that the local government is planning for. We have today urban growth boundaries that were acknowledged with a 20-year supply in, say, 1983, and a couple of cities I won't name have said to us, you know, as we look at this today, we probably have a 35-year supply. Well, how did that happen? It's because the assumptions for what that land supply was were so closely related with assumptions about how dense would housing develop in the next 20 years, how dense would industrial and commercial land develop, and a lot of other factors that are constantly changing and that we're constantly seeing improve, I believe, over time. I passed out to you a map showing all the urban growth boundaries statewide, and what you'll see on this map, it doesn't show up very well at this scale, but everything you see in red is an expansion of that boundary that happened since 1980. So if you look at these boundaries, I think you can discern that there hasn't been a great deal of expansion as a percentage since we first started with having UGBs. And I think one of the reasons for that is even though we had a 20-year supply going back, say, to 1979, as the years go by and cities revisit their plans and evaluate efficiency of land use in those UGBs, many cities are taking steps, and the market itself is taking steps, to increase the efficiency of land inside the UGB. Quickly going to the second question is what kind of a purpose was LCDC heading for? I said just a minute ago that I think LCDC was trying to strike a balance. I think this is as much art as science. I don't think there's a particular number that you could point to whether it had been a 15-year or a 25-year supply of land, and find anything in our records or in the literature that would demonstrate in any sort of scientific way that one is better than the other. But I think what LCDC was trying to do was to strike that balance between what is a number that's going to be too big, and as such, the urban growth boundary will not be an effective planning tool, and at the same time, make sure that the land supply was not so small that the spillover effects for, say, a surrounding community would be that community would have to absorb growth that it wasn't prepared for, or that there would be other kinds of consequences for surrounding regions. And this also appears in the literature that I've cited to here. I think it's impossible to determine what might have happened if we'd had a 15-year or a 25-year or some other number. So I'm not really prepared to say this has worked or we should change this. It's impossible to go back and look. But we do have a lot of information, especially studies of sprawl here compared to in other states, that demonstrate that the urban growth boundary in Oregon has vastly improved the, for example, the rate of the amount of land that is typically used in expansion of an urban area per population. In Oregon, that ratio is typically in an Oregon city, as it adds population, the amount of land per household is much lower than that is used in cities all across the country. So we have some evidence that this policy is working. I'm not saying it couldn't work better. I also have to say that in saying, does it still make sense and does it work today, that because it is so intertwined with policies on population forecasting and policies about efficient use of land, that the department is much less concerned about whether this is the right number than we are about how well those other policies are working. And in fact, we think there are big problems with population forecasting problems, policies, because in a recent survey we did, more than half the counties in the state have not been doing their required forecasting or maintaining their forecasts, their 20-year forecasts. And without those forecasts, cities are stymied as they try to reevaluate their urban growth boundaries. So I think that is a continuing issue that we have to deal with, and one that is closely tied to this. More importantly, efficiency measures, and it's a sort of a term of art that planners use, but what it really involves is, as each of the cities plans their urban growth boundary and adjust their plan at periodic review, cities are required to determine how much infill can they absorb, how much rezoning within the urban growth boundary for a variety of uses can cause redevelopment or higher densities of development or cause much more efficient uses of transportation and public facilities. We have growing costs of transportation and public facilities to the extent that in the last two major urban growth boundary amendments in the Portland metro area, while a large amount of land was added, that land still hasn't been developed because of infrastructure costs that have grown so high. So the efficiency issue is so much more important, and I think something that we are continuing to struggle with and work on, that again, it to us, it overshadows the question of whether the 20-year number is right. Finally, what we are growing more and more concerned about is spillover effects, and we recently saw some statistics that ODOT did about commuting between large urban centers, and we're talking about Portland, Eugene, Salem, Medford, and surrounding cities. And in some of those cases, Salem is a good example, in Portland also, you might find that 40% of the trips, auto trips, are to outlying cities. And as we start to think about greenhouse gas reduction and other kinds of things we're trying to achieve, we have to recognize that really this isn't about minding the store for the land supply for the large urban centers, say the boundaries of Eugene, Springfield, or Salem, or Portland. It's also what is the effect of those policies on the surrounding cities? How is it affecting those cities? And if we, as we do that adjusting, in what manner are we going to increase or decrease what it seems to be a growing problem of commuting to those surrounding areas? So I'll stop there. There's some other points I've made here, and I recognize you've got limited time, and be happy to answer any questions.
Sid, do you want to?
Sure. Chair Clem, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, Sid Friedman with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Bob Rindy, I think, did a pretty good job of laying out the history of the 20-year land supply and DLCD's historical interpretation of the Goal 14 requirement for a long-term supply of land as being a 20-year time period, or a maximum of 20 years. In 1995, that requirement was put into statute for residential uses only and for a limited number of cities. That limited number of cities has since been further limited, so where it now it applies only to 25,000 cities with a population of more than 25,000. And while this was consistent with agency practice, the result of putting that into statute made a number of citizens uneasy, both residents of urban areas and members of the agricultural community. They were anxious about both urban sprawl, inefficient land use, and loss of farmland. It's important to note that Goal 9, the goal dealing with economic development, also references a 20-year land supply for employment uses. So, is 20 years a 20-year time frame a sensible time frame for planning UGBs? As Bob pointed out, projection of a 20-year land supply involves population forecasts, employment forecasts, forecasts about household size, density of uses, and it is at best a mix of science and art. And that's demonstrated in particular by the fact that virtually every UGB that was established as a 20-year land supply lasted more than 20 years. And that wasn't just a result of more efficient and denser development. It also involved, in many cases, over forecasts or overly rosy or overly pessimistic, depending on your point of view, forecasts about population growth and also faulty assumptions about rapid job growth. So we've gotten better at making these guesstimates, but there are a number of factors that I think do suggest we should rethink whether or not 20 years makes sense, or whether it makes sense for all cities. There are several downsides to urban growth boundaries that are too large. The one we probably think of first is loss of farmland, and even though farmland included in a UGB may not develop immediately and may still be available to agriculture, once it's included in an urban growth boundary, nobody is going to invest in agriculture for that land anymore in terms of long-term investments. Nobody's going to tile a field. Nobody's going to plant a hazelnut orchard. And that has implications for the second largest sector of our economy here in Oregon, which is agriculture. And a large supply of cheap urbanizable land on the fringe also encourages low-density sprawl instead of reinvestment in existing neighborhoods, because you have that oversupply or that available land on the fringe that is often less expensive to purchase than land in the urban center. And it also has a negative impact on an oversupply of land also has a very large impact on infrastructure costs and infrastructure dollars, because, and I think Bob touched on this in the metro example, because once land is in a UGB, we plan to urbanize, we plan to supply it with infrastructure and begin to finance that infrastructure. There are tremendous implications. There's already too little money available for infrastructure in Oregon for land that is already within urban growth boundaries. And when we begin to spend that money both for planning and supplying infrastructure to new land on the urban fringe, it makes it much less likely that we'll be able to make sufficient investments in our existing neighborhoods and our existing commercial areas. One last point here. Projecting a 20-year land supply is particularly problematic for employment uses because of the changing nature of employment. What emerging industries, 20 years ago, people wouldn't have imagined some of the industries that we see now in the 19, when urban growth boundaries were established in the early 1980s, nobody would have said, oh, well, maybe we'll be have software development parks in 1999. And similarly, it's particularly difficult to make those kinds of judgments about what kind of land industry we'll be looking for. So that concludes our remarks. I guess I'll just summarize by saying there are significant downsides to having urban growth boundaries that are too large. And we have a historical record of including more than a 20-year land supply within our urban growth boundaries when we think we're including a 20-year land supply. And it does make sense, we think, to maybe rethink whether that's the right time frame. Thank you.
Sean? Good morning, Chair Dingfelder, Chair Clem. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I was surprised to find out that you can actually do research other than digital this morning, so thank you, Bob. And also, if Bob wasn't around for that, I definitely wasn't for the development of the 20-year land supply. But what I can talk about rather than the history is how Oregon Farm Bureau feels about the 20-year land supply. And it's very similar to how we feel about the current process for the urban rural reserves that Metro is going through currently in various cities around the state. Shortly, keeping things short, generally whenever there's a decision that's made that modifies a boundary, the ramifications are pretty heavy on the farmers in the EFU zone. So as we have our 20-year boundaries defined, as we go through, really what we have is a five-year opportunity for changes in those boundaries through periodic review. We end up with conflict where existing farmland that may be purchased, owned, leased by a area farmer comes into an opportunity for new conflict. And as those designations are made, the conflict zone, the buffer zone, as it is, providing that buffer between the urban setting and the rural setting, is usually eaten up by a portion of the farmer's land, because you have to deal with dust, pesticide applications, other smells and things that happen on the farm. So our land use process does provide a mechanism to slow growth, but it doesn't do it in a way that protects farmland for the long term. And whether or not the 20-year land supply is the best way to do that, I'm not really sure. It seems to be, from my perspective, we currently have a variety of mechanisms that are being employed or tested that dovetail with the 20-year land supply. It's hard for the Farm Bureau to predict right now whether or not that actually is a net benefit for the farming communities or not. But generally, farmers, especially in the Washington County, Willamette Valley area, are not a big fan of the 20-year land supply. So I guess that's all I have to say.
Mr. Chandler.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked and astonished. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Mr. Rindy did an excellent job on the history. I was not around doing this in 1979, unlike some on my panel here. I was, in fact, around. But it's very, you get back into the mists of the Oregon land use mythology, it's very difficult to find exactly where this particular requirement came up. And I've often thought about it as kind of, it's the Goldilocks requirement. It's not too big, not too small. 20 years is as good a number as any. It's not, it could be 18 and a half, it could be 21 and three quarters. The point was to have enough land that you had market choice, that you had some guidance for the cities, that you had some ability to maneuver your planning as your community grew and morphed and developed, but not so much, so small an amount that it caused price spikes or artificial scarcity or people, like Mr. Rindy pointed out, to move to the next town over when they do that already. And that was a concern 30 years ago. It's even more of a concern today when we're focusing on vehicle mile travel, greenhouse gas reductions, and other things that we didn't have any idea about when the program started. As Mr. Friedman pointed out, there were some rosy assessments made when we first started. I would also point out to you, though, that an unfortunate corollary to today's times, most of the plans were acknowledged in the early 80s, and right after, and I'm not sure if it's causal or not, I've always wondered about this, right after that, state's economy went in the tank. I think hiring a bunch of land use planners probably directly contributed, but I can't prove that. So, of course, the scenarios look pretty rosy because growth stopped in Oregon in the early 80s. What it was a 20-year supply of land, had the 70s continued, may well have been a 20-year supply of land. As it played out, it was a 30-some-year supply. If we were doing them today and trying to do 20-year land supplies based on today's market, you'd get a substantially different number than if you did 20-year land supply based on 2005's market. That's the part of the reason we have that long time period, is because we can't project not only housing types, economic changes, or anything of the sort, but you can't project what the economy is going to do. And that has a dramatic effect on what happens on your in each community. It, to me, and I would encourage the committee, I think there's a good conversation to have about land use planning. The Big Look started it, the bill last session continued it. I would encourage you not to focus on 20 years. 20 years is symbolic. It by itself doesn't do anything. Urban growth boundaries by themselves don't do much. They're the most understandable and easily accessible parts of Oregon's land use system, certainly, compared to all the minutia. But they probably, if we were to not have a 20-year land supply and we weren't to have urban growth boundaries, I'm not sure we'd be developing a whole lot differently because we could figure out different tools to use to accomplish the same objective. In my time, 20 years playing around this issue, the fights always happen on urban growth boundary expansions. They happen in the out years. They happen over years 17 to 20. None of us know when we're arguing about it and going to LUBA and litigating. We don't know what's going to happen any more than if we do who's going to win the series then. So what we haven't grappled with as a state, and what I'd encourage you if you're looking for a place to spend some time, I would like you to do this, focus on how we get to year 15. How do we pay for infrastructure? How do we handle roads and sewer and water systems? How do you give communities the tools to grow their economies in a productive, sustainable fashion? How do you avoid the spillover effect of locally, whether it's affordable housing or low-income housing or manufactured housing or anything else that might be locally unwanted? How do you keep communities from keeping themselves clean, if you will, from that and forcing it to the next community down the road? In my previous life, I was on the Redmond City Council during the early 80s, which may have been a causal factor too, I suppose, now that I think about it. And I can tell you, as you all know this, what happened in Bend affected Redmond. What happened in Redmond affected Prineville. What happened in Prineville affected Madras. We don't have yet a good system for looking at how to manage that and how to help communities, particularly smaller communities, deal with being within the orbit of a larger community. Population forecasting Mr. Rindy mentioned is part of that, but even beyond that is the department and the legislation that gives rise to the department's authority, maybe giving them some extra tools on how to help communities and counties work together to develop the economy. I understand the concerns the Farm Bureau has. I'm not sure what to do about them. By a matter of geographic accident, development land and farmland and aggregate land and other sorts of land tend to be in the same places. It is going to be a conflict that has to be managed. There's no way to make growth happen in some place where there's not good agricultural land because the federal government was giving that stuff away not that many years ago and there weren't any takers. I suspect if they were to start doing it again, there wouldn't be many takers. The growth is going to occur in Oregon, good or ill, between the Willamette Valley, where the good farmland is, and where the good aggregate sites are, and where the good fish habitat is, and all the other things that go along with the conflicts inherent in any sort of dynamic economy. We wouldn't like changing the 20-year rule, and we'd probably fight about it. Having said that, I'm not sure that's necessarily a very productive discussion. It might be kind of entertaining. I think the real issue, I would encourage you to work on, I'd certainly offer to help, is how to grow our state, how to build the economy, how to protect resources, how to protect agriculture, how to do the things that are already in the goals. And if you want to add in greenhouse gases, in case we get bored, we could do that. How do we do that? Rather than going down a path of worried about whether or not 20 years is the right number versus 15 or 25 or something else, the real issue is how to get those first few years done, how to pay for them, how to manage them, how to live there, how to work there. It's what kept me in this game for quite a while. So I think it's a very interesting, stimulating, and ultimately extraordinarily important activity that we're all about. If we actually focus on the pieces, I think, in my humble opinion, that really matter. With that, Mr. Chairman, I suspect we can take questions if there's time. Madam Chair?
Questions, House members?
Responsive opinion.
On the Senate side?
We'll pass.
Mm-hmm. No questions?
I've just one.
I'm sure the chairs will have questions.
Yeah, I don't have a lot, but how do we factor in, I don't know if it's a formula or, you know, what someone's doing, they're forecasting. How do you factor in density? Into a 20-year supply. I assume a 20-year supply isn't, we say, how long would it take at one story before we have to build out? Being in Hong Kong recently, I realized that at some point they had to figure out, just geographically bound, that their whole supply was up and there is no more out. It's just a little physically impossible. And so have some balance in between of one story and, perennially up only.
Mr. Chair, the process for establishing a boundary, and of course nobody's doing that anymore except, I guess, the new city of Lapine, but certainly the process for amending a boundary, as I mentioned earlier, it's not about 20-year supply, because by itself that doesn't mean anything. Any city that is evaluating their land supply, as they do with periodic review, or as more and more are doing outside of periodic review because they believe they're exhausting their supply of land, they start with forecasts about population and household size, and ultimately they get to questions of what is the forecasted, for example, housing density, or density of employment land, whether it's industrial and commercial and other uses, and schools and a lot of other things. And that exercise by land use planners, it's not really transparent to the public, but it does involve all of the calculations you're asking about. Mostly those are assumptions. Most of those assumptions are based not only on what's been occurring in the past 5 years or the past 10, but other trends and other information they can gather that would help them predict what would be the density of housing, what would be a good guess for the density of housing 20 years from now. And using that information, each community begins an urban growth expansion or evaluating their boundary with a calculation of how much land they really have, if the infill that they might recognize as a possibility, if that infill takes place, if housing starts to develop more densely, if housing is redeveloped more densely. And when they're all done with that exercise, they spit out a number then that says, well, really what we have available is another 5 years or another 2 years, or we're short and we need to add land to the boundary. The goal 14 actually requires each city to take measures to increase the efficiency within the boundary, or to demonstrate what measures they have taken or will take before they're even allowed to go to the next step of expanding the boundary. We recently LCDC adopted a series of what we call safe harbors, and what those do is they streamline the UGB process immensely. They take away a lot of steps for an urban growth boundary expansion by putting right down on paper if a jurisdiction will assume a much more dense future housing, and there's numbers in there, that they automatically can use those numbers. Nobody can dispute them, and they can just go to the next step. And the idea of those safe harbors is they encourage cities to, rather than try and make these guesstimates or do all this work, is just to take some numbers that we've come up with a work group as a consensus process with a lot of stakeholders. If they will take some housing density numbers that we've offered them in the safe harbor, use them, they can shortcut a lot of the process. It just started. We don't have any numbers to tell you whether this is working. It's totally voluntary. But it is one of the improvements we've looked at, and we're going to be looking at some other improvements to try to encourage cities to, in fact, anticipate and plan for higher densities in the future.
Mr. Chair,
Senator, and I was going to say, Senator Boquist has just a couple of quick points. We're going to have to wrap up, but if you want to
just very quickly, I would like to point out, Mr. Chairman, members, that there's two other factors relating to density that you ought not lose track of. One is the marketplace, that you can plan for whatever density you want, but you can't build it and sell it. It doesn't make a lot of difference. And the other is that density is far easier to do in concept than it is to do in actuality. As former and perhaps future Governor Kitzhaber said one time, there's two things Oregonians hate: one is sprawl, the other is density. It's very difficult, I can speak with some personal experience here, it's very difficult to do high-density projects. In fact, it's easier in this state, notwithstanding 30 years of land use planning, it's easier to do single-family detached in every city. I will say this categorically. In every city in Oregon, it's easier to do single-family detached on a big lot than it is to do a row house. And that ought not be, but there you have it.
Right, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Manager. Just three quick points and observations, because we're talking about 20-year supply, and I appreciate it being brought on the calendar. In my district, I've got some cities, and Bob's familiar with this, that have vastly exceeded their 20-year forecast. I mean, they're just well beyond it. I mean, they're not even in the same ballpark at all. And the problem, of course, comes back to the counties don't have any funds to do population studies. The next thing is people don't care what the population study says. They're going to where their jobs are. And as I think everybody said here, economics drives expansion, and it's almost impossible to predict the future, even in the global warming, greenhouse, whatever side. If we're going to create green jobs, okay, that wasn't in the plan 20 years ago. And so we really do need to kind of look at how we're implementing this if we're going to get there.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I think we are definitely going to be continuing this conversation. I think there's a lot of factors that came up here that are really useful. And, you know, just one last observation, for instance, some of the assumptions that were used in, when you were doing rulemaking, I mean, you can look at how many things have changed just since that time of when those rules were adopted. So really appreciate your thoughts and observations. And I'm just going to close us up by giving a brief update on the Destination Resort Work Group, just for members to know, and their Representative Clem is also sitting on that work group along with Representative Wisnett, so I appreciate that. We've been meeting. We have a very active discussion about future legislation, so I just wanted to give folks an update. We're looking at legislation in February 2010 and then possibly also in 2011, but we are starting somewhat from scratch. And, you know, there was a lot of discussions last session. We've sort of gone back to what was the original intent of Destination Resort regulations and statutes and reevaluating, you know, very similar to this discussion. Those were adopted over 20 plus years ago. Things have changed, the market's changed, reevaluating some of those assumptions. So all I could say at this point is stay tuned, because most likely if there's legislation comes out of my committee, I'll probably be coming over here. So I just wanted to give you a brief update. Many of the folks in the audience are serving on that work group. We have a broad representation of stakeholders, and so stay tuned, and Representative Clem can probably provide you an update in January. So with that, I think we're on time.
For the first time all day, adjourn my House committee.
And I'll adjourn the Senate committee, and thank you, Beth. Thank you, Representative.